Sensational. What a system. Okay.
Right, so we're ready to go, are we?
Well, yeah.
We're doing it.
I don't have a... I haven't kind of planned anything. It's just my...
No, fine, well...
characteristic incompetence and things.
Yeah.
So, let me just... Okay, let me just do a bit of scene. We're now in Michael Bernie Elliott's basement flat. It's very sunny.
Yes, my underground lair.
It's underground lair. We're completely surrounded by... artworks and reproductions of artworks.
No, they're all artworks, actually.
Are they?
No prints.
Originals.
Yes.
Oh, right. And sort of red chalk and
yes.
Hefty volumes.
Yes.
Illustrations, one has
yes.
a little doubt. Okay, we're just discussing viruses, polio, Salk, and the US government knowing about retroviruses. I think that's a...
Yes, well, you see, Salk first devised the polio vaccine, which used a killed virus in the vaccine to provoke an antibody response. And but the problem with that one was it only afforded temporary protection. You had to have repeats. And so it was argued that a live virus vaccine using an attenuated virus would be infinitely preferable because it would afford longer protection. So Albert Sabin and Hilary Koprowski, between them, developed a live virus vaccine using three different strains of the most known strains of poliovirus,
yeah,
but attenuated.
Cultivated on chick embryos or something?
They were cultivated on monkey kidney tissues.
Oh, right, yeah.
You see, the problem with an attenuated virus is if it's a human virus, you attenuate it by straining it through a different animal species, which changes it genetically. It automatically happens that it changes genetically.
Mm.
But then in order not to compromise the attenuation, you then have to make sure that the virus stays attenuated. But if you then started to try and propagate it in human cells, it might revert to its former virulence. So you have to keep it in animal cells.
I thought the technique was to use chick embryos, but maybe...
Well, chick embryos is yellow fever vaccine and that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Until that started to give everybody hepatitis, and then they realised there was something wrong with that as well, because chick embryos can carry bugs. So, it was a big rivalry between Salk and Sabin. There was
right.
a major disaster involving a firm called Cutter Laboratories in California, whereby the virus that had alleged to be killed, was allegedly killed, in fact wasn't properly killed, and many children...
When you say killed, you mean actually killed? It was treated in some way?
It was treated with formalin and various other chemicals. But the stuff wasn't properly... The viral particles weren't killed off. So children and adults who were in the same family, several died, and a lot were given paralytic polio. So eventually the Sabin vaccine prevailed and became the most widely used. But immediately they noticed that, for instance, in Canada, in a certain area where there had been little or no polio, everybody started to take the polio vaccine just in case. And cases of paralytic polio shot up by 400% after they started using the vaccine. And Jonas Salk actually testified before an American committee in the 1970s, pointing out that every single case of paralytic polio that's occurred since the 1960s was directly linked to live polio vaccine.
When they linked to the people that had injected?
Had. Only those who had had live polio vaccine.
It was a one-to-one?
Yeah. It was absolutely 100% correlation. So there was a lot of rivalry between Salk and Sabin, but what got me first started into this, was there something in the polio vaccines? Was there a precedent? Had this ever happened before, particularly, specifically in the case of polio vaccine? And there was. By the time millions of people had been given either the Salk or the Sabin vaccines in 1960...
These were experimented within...
The experiments were carried out usually in poor communities in the United States, including a lot of black people,
mm-hmm.
and some of the most massive experiments carried out were in Central Equatorial Africa, in Uganda, what is now known as the AIDS Belt
mm-hmm.
in Africa, Uganda, Zaire, well, Delta Congo as it was then,
yeah.
and for instance, in Leopoldville as it was, 75,000 children alone were vaccinated using.
This was experimental.
Well, it was all, you see, the pharmaceutical companies are quite cute. You test your vaccines in a third world country, and then this is a major disaster. They won't even have the money to sue you.
Mm.
If anything goes wrong, you can hush it up.
So you're saying, right, so they presumably
all these vaccines were tested, but whether they were being tested or actually being used, as Salk vaccines were at that time, you know, having been cleared for takeoff, Sweet and Hillman, two virologists, discovered a monkey virus which was the 40th virus identified from a monkey species. Therefore, it was known as SV40. And this was brand new. They'd only just discovered it in the tissues of rhesus monkeys. And when they searched the vaccines, lo and behold, it was present in the vaccines. By then, millions of people had been exposed to the vaccine, and we know that millions of people were infected with SV40.
Mm.
Now, when SV40 was used in... They had to put it into a cell transformation assay to see exactly what it does, and that always uses human cells.
Can I just ask if this is a retrovirus or a virus?
No, it's just a straight virus. It's a double-stranded DNA virus, and in fact it can integrate itself into the host cell's genome, but it is not a retrovirus. Its genetic material is contained in the form of a double-stranded DNA.
Can I just ask if you're happy about all this virological science, are you? Because there's a friend of mine, I mean, Hillman, if you read my letter, who's...
Yeah, sure.
Who's been... I mean, they're detected either by electron microscopy or by...
Oh, well, they did all the immuno... or electrophoresis or whatever. All the various techniques. They didn't have PCR at that time, of course.
Mm.
But...
Okay. The only reason I say that is because there are, in my view, there are severe doubts as to... reliability.
Well, SV40 was definitely identified and characterized and called SV40, blah blah.
Because simian virus 40, completely unoriginal.
Yes, simian virus 40. And what the interesting facts were that the treatment used to kill the virus in the killed Salk vaccine was not sufficient to deactivate the SV40. So even the killed virus vaccine contained it, and certainly the live virus vaccine contained it, while they were using Indian rhesus monkeys to manufacture the vaccine. Now, when they tested the virus in human cell cultures, they noticed that it damaged the chromosomes, immortalized the human cells, and were therefore highly carcinogenic, or considered potentially carcinogenic.
Which immortalized, you mean in the same way that HeLa cells were?
Well, yes, yeah. To become something like HeLa cells, immortalized. What's the difference between immortalized and cancerous?
I've never heard that expression, but I know what you mean.
Yes, in other words... They are put into a precancerous state.
Mm.
So this caused panic in the vaccine community. And they thought, my God, what have we done? We've given all these children, particularly children, a virus which may cause cancer, blah, blah. And so they waited with bated breath. And by 1967, they had a conference organized by the NIH in November, where all the vaccine designers, manufacturers, doctors, etc. got together and presented all the latest evidence and epidemiological evidence, and were able to say, I presume they were telling the truth, that there didn't seem to be a significant rise in the numbers of cancers, particularly in infants.
Okay, well, there has been... I mean, the cancer virus link has definitely is not been established properly, has it?
No, it hasn't.
So that's not
unsurprising. So they were quite convinced. Now, however, only last year...
Do you want an ashtray?
Oh, I've got one down here. Phyllida de Brown... in The New Scientist, Alex found it for me, pointed out that they are now finding cases of mesothelioma, which is usually caused by asbestos, you know, asbestosis. 80% of the mesothelioma cases in America, for instance, are associated with asbestos. But they were finding simian virus 40 being re-expressed and whole particles, etc., in the bloodstream of people with mesothelioma.
Hmm.
So you thought, well, what does this mean? They've also found it in rare bone cancers and brain tumours. So it looks as if the possibility is that a virus that has lain dormant for many years has now come back to haunt us. Because the only way these people would have got their SV40 was from the vaccine.
Hmm.
It's not known to be horizontally transmitted between people, you know, by blood and whatever, unless, of course, a blood transfusion contains it. So, having pronounced it safe in 1968...
It doesn't actually have to remain dormant, does it? I mean, if a cancer cell started 20 or 30 years ago, it would have... You know, as long as they grow slowly...
Yes, but you see, it can be dormant, and then something will trigger it.
Well, what I mean is that's consistent, consistent with the virus being... with you not having to adopt the dormancy theory. I mean, they could have got the cancer cell all that time ago, and if it's slow enough growing, you would not notice it for...
Yes, but in the normal course of events... an aberrant cell would just die off, because you know cells have only got a limited shelf life anyway. When Robin Weiss was interviewed, who is one of our leading AIDS researchers, by The New Scientist later on, he said, well, the fact is, at the moment, we just don't know whether it's causing or contributing to the cancers. We just don't know. So I thought, well, if this happened on such a wide scale and we discovered this by 1960, that monkey viruses could and did contaminate polio vaccines, and could and did and were associated with cancer. Has it happened since then? You see, what happened in 1960, there were two events. One, the Indian government stopped exporting rhesus monkeys because of representations made to them by the Hindu community. They venerate monkeys, of course, so that was nandied by the Indian government. Okay. Two, the Indian rhesus was a natural reservoir of SV40. So in their panic, they switched to another species. And guess what they chose? African green monkeys, because they were cheap, plentiful. From the 60s onwards, they were exporting 10,000 animals a year from sub-Saharan Africa for use in vaccine manufacture and for testing the vaccines. Because you constantly have to do a quality control by injecting live animals with the vaccine to see whether there are any, whether there's any brain dysfunction in the animals. So anyway, within... then everything went quiet until about 1976.
Yeah, by the way, presumably Salk and Sabin developed their vaccines on both of these types of monkeys, did they?
They developed them originally in Indian rhesus.
Oh, right, that's the 50s, wasn't it?
In the 50s. That's in the 50s.
This, okay.
Yeah. So from the early 1960s onwards, the standard cell culture used to make polio vaccines by most of the manufacturers was the African greens. A, because it permitted successful propagation of the polio virus, they were cheap, cheerful, plentiful, you know. So anyway, by 1976, they all seemed to be going well, except, of course, they had noticed that a lot of people who were getting live polio vaccine were also developing paralytic polio. But that still didn't stop the wheels of big business. You'd say, that's just an acceptable risk, they say. You protect the majority, it doesn't matter the minority, you're actually getting the disease they're being vaccinated against. But that's always been the case.
Yes, that's right. You accept yourself, don't you?
Yes. So, you see, that's the way you work the scam. When a disease is disappearing, and don't forget polio was on the wane before they even introduced the vaccines. You'll find this with most of the major diseases that they introduced a vaccine for. So that if you can then persuade people to take a vaccine against something that isn't going to happen anyway, you can say, yes, but it's not happening because you're using our vaccine. And it's like the gag of the man with a flit spray in Oxford Street. Do you know the story?
It sounds like the chap with the
axe
in the
flit spray in Oxford Street. And the policeman says, excuse me, hello, what are you doing? He says, I'm getting rid of the elephants. He said, well, there aren't any elephants. He said, yes, it's working, isn't it?
That's right.
That's exactly what they do with the vaccine story.
It's like the chap with the axe in the Sahara.
Yeah. So anyway, all was well until 1976. You see, I got onto this theory and was sort of trying to see whether HIV was in fact a simian virus that has somehow by accident got into the human bloodstream. So I was in touch with this doctor called Dr. Eva Lee Sneed in San Antonio, Texas.
And can I just interrupt? She's still I saw a copy of her book, her double-volume book.
Oh, yes, the huge
thing. Some called it AIDS, I call it Murder, I think was the title.
Yes.
Strangely written, isn't it? All kind of full of linguistic things about... gallo meaning cock, that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, quite.
And well,
I went...
Malherb meaning
I met the lady in 1988
She got struck off, I think, didn't she?
Well, yes, but then that was for over-prescribing drugs to druggies.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, and then... in fact, it wasn't... They claimed that that's what it was for. In fact, her husband was a drug addict and was pushing dope. So she divorced him. Anyway, she was a very mad lady. But nevertheless, she put me onto the simian virus 40 thing in a big way. So then, I thought, well, what does it matter now that I've met Duisberg, and he's obviously explained the kinetics of retroviruses, etc., because... You see, he's one of the world's leading authorities, if not the leading authority, on retroviruses.
I thought he more or less invented them.
That's a very good way of saying it.
We'll discover them,
aren't we? Yeah. So anyway, then in 1992, The Lancet published a piece pointing out that in 1970... Can I help?
I thought I wanted my glasses. I put them down.
Oh.
Oh,
oh dear.
It doesn't really matter. It just occurred to me that I didn't have the ornament in my pocket. Never mind, I'll spot them.
So,
in
1992, The Lancet published a piece by a man called Walter S. Kyle, who is a lawyer who specialises in criminal injuries cases.
It's K-Y-L-E, is it?
K-Y-L-E.
What is
that? Kyle. K-Y-L-E, yes, Walter S. Kyle. And he published an article in The Lancet pointing out that in 1976, the American Bureau of Biologics, which is like their quality control organisation, had found contaminant particles in polio vaccines under electron microscopy, clearly visible because they were three times the size of the polio virus that should have been there. So they saw the actual polio virus, which is about between 28 and 30 nanometers in diameter, but they also saw these contaminant particles, which were 90 nanometers in diameter, three times the size.
Well, 27 times the size.
So the supposition was that they might be onconoviruses, the group of retroviruses that carry an oncogene and therefore are the ones that cause cancer in laboratory animals. So panic stations, they had to identify what the viruses were, and according to an assay that they had only devised the previous year to detect reverse transcriptase activity, they were able to confirm that the type C RNA, that they were type C RNA viruses. Now that's virology speak for retroviruses. So the American government immediately went to American government level. It was that serious. Because you see, if they found them in 1976, how long had they been making vaccines and giving them to people containing these contaminants?
And why didn't they notice before?
Well, precisely. So anyway, the American government co-opted a committee, or formed a committee, with the full cooperation of the National Institutes of Health, the Bureau of Biologics, and the Food and Drugs Administration. And after an unprecedented 20 months of deliberations, during which time they must have tested these particles on human cells to see whether they would cause mutation in the chromosomes and make them immortalize or kill the cells. Obviously they didn't, because they cleared the vaccine for takeoff, providing that the manufacturers limited the number of contaminant particles to no more than 100 per milliliter of vaccine, per dose of vaccine. 100 being considered a safe dose. Prior to that, the vaccines that they'd examined had contained between 1,000 and 100,000 retroviral particles per dose. So, now what Kyle suggested was that why was there a predominance of gay men with HIV stroke AIDS? I mean, he writes it from the orthodox view that HIV is the cause of AIDS, obviously. Why the preponderance of gay men? He cites examples since 1974, two papers recommending the use of live polio vaccine as a treatment for the genital herpes epidemic that was whizzing around the United States at that time. And that hit the gay community particularly hard. So we know that gay men were in the habit of taking several monthly doses of live polio vaccine. This was the Salk, the Sabin live vaccine. At the time, it was heavily contaminated, with up to 100,000 particles per milliliter of vaccine.
But you mean
as a treatment against herpes?
How bizarre was that?
Totally bizarre. Incidentally, as I put in my piece, there's in 1985, somebody obtained a patent to use typhoid vaccine as a treatment for people with AIDS, to give their immune system a kick, you know, kick it back into gear. So anyway, where had we got to? That's what Kyle alleges. Oh, and incidentally, we found out via Robert Root Bernstein, who is another one of the AIDS dissident crowd, who wrote his book, you know, Rethinking AIDS. He mentions that Rock Hudson used the polio vaccine for just that purpose.
Not with great success, it would appear.
Well, no. Mm. So, but the point being that the biggest flaw in my theory was they didn't just vaccinate children, because I'm mainly concentrating on the the childhood vaccine thing, who would either grow up to be gay or drug addicts. They vaccinated everybody, males and females in equal proportions. So that was a flaw in theory. So then I thought, well, everybody has made the assumption is that the assumption that everybody has made is that the number of HIV positive cases you find reflect the number of people who are infected. They don't. According to my theory, what it actually reflects is the number of people who have a reactivated, dormant infection. Gallo himself admits that HIV can be dormant. Now, what put me onto this was, I don't know whether you know, in 1987, the Times, starting in May the 11th, the Times started to do a series of, well, it was nipped in the bud, so it was only about two or three articles linking the World Health Organization's anti-smallpox vaccination campaign with the spread of AIDS in Africa and various other countries where there was intense anti-smallpox vaccination. Had the smallpox campaign spread AIDS?
Right, you mean as a side effect, not you mean they accept the view that it's...
Well, had dirty contaminated needles or whatever, you know, where they would use the same needle on 50 people in Africa or wherever.
They weren't criticising the smallpox
necessarily. No, but they were saying that the campaign itself might have been inadvisable. And when Robert Gallo was asked for a comment on it, he said that he had, for a long time he'd been warning against the dangers of live polio vaccination, that they might reactivate a dormant HIV infection. So he acknowledged the probability that HIV could remain dormant. Now I'm suggesting, what my piece suggests is, that HIV is in fact SIV. There aren't any human retroviruses. Now, the Liddell vaccine inquiry into the contaminants in the polio vaccines gave their recommendations in 1977. Within a year, Robert Gallo found the first human retrovirus. Prior to that, he'd alleged to find a human retrovirus in 1975, which turned out to be simian contaminants in human cells in his laboratory. And he always claims to this day, he doesn't know how it happens, but he suspected that his researches were being spiked by jealous rivals, etc. But anyway, that was monkey viruses in human cells in somebody's lab. A year after the Liddell vaccine, or within a year of them finding their, making their findings, Gallo came up with the first human retrovirus. Simultaneously, the Japanese came up with the same one, which was called HTLV-1.
The very first one. I didn't realise it was such a kind of historical thing.
Oh yes, in 1978, Gallo first found it.
So Duisberg hadn't found one. Duisberg had invented.
He'd studied retroviruses,
but not in humans.
Until 1978, there weren't any. Despite the most intensive searches for human retroviruses, there weren't any. And when they found two within 4 or 5 years, which, funnily enough, have the only close relatives they have are in African green monkeys, which have been used in the polio vaccines.
Right.
So what we're meant to believe is that these human retroviruses were lurking in the human bloodstream for millennia and waited until the very year that Gallo found had got the right equipment available to find them before causing a disease. Because the only disease they could pin these HTLV retroviruses onto was adult T-cell leukemia, which wasn't noticed anywhere in the world until Japan in 1978. So the diseases are as novel as the retroviruses.
T-cell leukemia, you're saying that's a brand new disease?
Mm. Yes. So nobody had ever seen it before. And then you think, well, that's weird. I mean, come on, didn't anybody think this was a bit of a coincidence? But then the same buggers pulled the same switch in 84 with HIV. So you've got this. Can I just read you my list of coincidences? Because this is a neat way of putting it. It's as neat a way as I can think of.
Where is that? Where have you submitted this?
Yeah, page 13. Well, it's going to be published in a magazine, yeah.
Well,
but it's still under wraps at the moment, yeah.
Okay.
It says, now, it cannot be mere coincidence that two novel human retroviruses, HTLV, that's a type C, and HIV, a notably unstable lentivirus, which had close animal relatives in African green monkeys, one of the few primate species found to carry both STLV, a type C, and SIV, a notably unstable lentivirus, in up to 70% of wild-caught African green monkeys, whose cells were widely used in polio vaccine production from the early 1960s, were found so soon after the Liddell vaccine inquiry in 1976-77 into retrovirus-contaminated polio vaccines, and alleged to cause two diseases, adult T-cell leukemia and AIDS, as suspiciously novel as the retroviruses. So I've gone on to say, no one could believe in such an eightfold cascade of simultaneous unconnected coincidences. However, this is where the gullibility cofactor kicked in to the advantage of the retroviruses. That's just my sort of personal view. No one considered then that it was incredible that not one, but two human retroviruses had been quietly lurking in the human bloodstream, considerately waiting to cause two new diseases until exactly the same time that retroviruses came under such intense scrutiny. Now that's not on. It just cannot have been that way.
Can you just read that one paragraph just spoke about Tim Gallo talking about turning HIV into SIV?
That's just purely ad hominem attack.
It's a very good...
I mean, yes, I mean, you see, what I've suggested is... almost from the outset, hang on.
Where is it? Can I just find it for
you? I found it.
It's a very good paragraph. That's
now, I'm just saying, I suggest, and this is strictly off the record, okay?
Sure. Well, it's being taped.
Yeah.
Stop it if you like.
What Gallo says?
I suggest that in finding the first human, in inverted commas, retrovirus, Gallo cynically capitalised on the findings of the contaminated vaccine inquiry in 1977 and merely took a calculated risk, identifying the first of two simian viruses, both subsequently found in African green monkeys, which had contaminated live polio vaccines for the previous 20 years. Just as before in 1975, Gallo had merely found a simian retrovirus in human cancer cells, STLV, and made it human by calling it HTLV. The same cynical scientific legerdemain, perhaps prompted by a US governmental desire for damage containment, later turned SIV into HTLV-3, HIV. As Lady Bracknell might have observed, to find one simian human retrovirus may be regarded as opportune. To find two seems like sheer opportunism. Gallo's colleagues Myron Essex and Phyllis Kanke made one trip too many to the same well in 1986 and isolated HIV-3, which they called HTLV-4. Like Gallo's first attempt to demonstrate a human retrovirus, this was again a soup of simian contaminants, including SIV, grown in human cell lines. As Robin Weiss and Richard Tedder explain, HTLV-4 was found to represent a laboratory contamination of human cell lines with SIV, and the detection of apparently specific antibodies was due to antigenic cross-reactivity between HIV-2 and SIV. So they've admitted that SIV was contaminating everything anyway, even in laboratory cultures, so God knows what was in the vaccine.
What is your sources for all this? What is your methodology?
I've quoted a lot of... That's most of my sources.
I'm working in the science library at UCL, and I do most help to a lot of researchers, but it's all in the major scientific...
Do you mean the one in that part, branch of the British Museum?
No, it's DMS Watson Library, University College London.
It's University College London's own science library.
Yeah. And that's where...
So you see, the nose of my piece is that there are no human retroviruses. Indeed, no human retroviruses. You see, according to Peter Duisberg, who is my guru as far as retrovirology is concerned, and Carrie Mullis, who invented PCR, primary chain reaction, all the human genomes are littered with retroviral genomes that could or could not be expressed. We've all got hundreds of them in us. Why are the only two that ever bubble to the surface and the only two that we've ever found, why do they have these embarrassing simian relatives? You see, I've put, claim that as human primates we've inherited those retroviruses from a distant common simian ancestor is a complete cop-out. African green monkeys must be pretty remote from humans on the primate family tree, not nearly as close as, for instance, chimpanzees. In other words, what they've suggested is that a common simian ancestor, after the simian branches diverged into the lower primates and the higher primates and eventually man, it hung around in the lower primates, skipped the higher primates, and was still in man. You think, well, come on, this just isn't on. Now, they must have realised the flaw in this, and they were desperately anxious to prove that chimpanzees were infected in the wild. So if you look in any major textbook now on the subject, on simian retroviruses, you will find chimpanzees listed as naturally infected. This is based principally on two animals. When the first one was found in Gabon, Luc Montagnier, the other guy who really found the AIDS virus, or rather his team did, actually stated at the time, in his opinion, that the chimpanzee had probably escaped from the very primate research centre in Gabon that eventually identified the virus. So on the basis of two animals that were positive for an SIV test, they claimed that chimpanzees are infected in the wild. Then why have they only found two of them? Why have none of the ones that have been captured prior to this?
They've attempted to test them.
Well, I presume they've done tests on all the other chimps. But they've only found two chimps naturally infected. You see, one has to make the distinction of wild-caught animals and animals that have been in primate research centres or in commercial trade.
Sure, yeah.
Because even when they're just commercially sold, they put different species together in the gang pens where they're kept in transit, etc. And they naturally cross-infect each other. And they've noticed since 1960 that from primate research centres all over America, that monkeys were getting sick and dying who shouldn't have ever encountered each other in the wild. For instance, monkeys from Asia were being kept cheek by jowl with monkeys from Africa, and they were giving each other bugs and killing each other off. So the more you look at the arguments, the more you realise... Oh, so let me get back to my main flaw, the main flaw of my theory. was that they didn't just vaccinate. Why is it in the West that AIDS still is restricted to certain risk group of people?
Yeah, right.
They are what people don't seem to realise is the risk is of getting a reactivating pathogen and or drugs. You see, drugs are a powerful mitogen, and mitogenic stimulation stimulates retroviruses into activity. That's the only way they can get retroviruses to replicate in a laboratory, in your cell culture. If the cell culture is resting, you won't get any retrovirus. Mm-hmm. So you've got to pump the cell cultures full of either phytohemagglutinin or concalvalin A or pokeweed mitogen. You've got to make those cells divide.
That's always
now, we know that some drugs are powerful mitogens, cocaine, for instance. They're all plant derivatives, by the way.
And that's the reason a lot of gay men are testing positives, because they have incredible amount of antibiotics and street drugs and that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
So they're testing positive not because they've been infected sexually by a virus, but because, do you say this thing's already dormant within them, it's just been woken up.
Since they've received their polio vaccine.
And it's woken up, they've been stimulated by...
another factor is you'll find a high incidence of HIV positivity in countries that have compulsory polio vaccination. America and France. Why has France got a completely atypical HIV positivity rate?
I don't know about France. Is that the case? France has had
compulsory polio vaccination since the 60s.
You're saying they've got very high...
And they have a very... Yeah. They have an atypically high HIV positivity rate.
It's certainly higher than this country.
They've got the highest rate in Europe per capita, apart from Switzerland, who have also had compulsory polio vaccination.
I had no idea that France had a particular...
Oh, yes. Everybody's noticed. It does seem incredible that France is... Why France particularly? They haven't got any more gays per capita. They haven't got any more... The machine's going. Yeah. They haven't got any more gays per capita, proportionately... Than any other country.
You hear the stuff in Africa. I've never heard about France having a high...
Also, they seem to have a high rate of women. Now, some people have tried to suggest that, you know, this is because more French women enjoy anal sex and blah, blah, blah. Why they're quite so convinced that anal sex has got anything to do with... Let's face it, a virus that's got to depend on sodomy and smack for its survival hasn't got much of a future.
Right. Do you... Okay, I see the points you're getting at, I think.
It cannot be mere coincidence that, you see, all the SIVs infect human cells. That much we know. One of the big arguments, even if SIV had been present in the vaccine, it wouldn't have been infectious because it was orally administered. But Alex found a marvellous paper published last June by Ruth Ruprecht and her colleagues at the Dana-Farber Institute. And what they were trying to test was, using animal modelling, was there a danger that cell-free virus in semen would be infectious orally, in orally unprotected sex, if semen was ingested?
Hmm.
So to do this, they used the macaques as the animal model.
Okay, you're talking about the liquid without sperms in it, is that what you're saying? Cell-free liquid,
Well, no, cell-free... let me explain the experiment. They wanted to know... You see... Cell-free HIV has never been found in semen, and yet the legend is that that's regularly how it's transmitted. So when you quiz them on this, you say, in that case it must be being transmitted intracellularly. That means the cell has to get into the receptive person's bloodstream and remain there long enough and under the right mitogenic stimuli to yield up retroviral particles.
Mm.
But retroviruses have never been found naturally in semen without intensive, several weeks, of culturing. Why not? So to test the theory whether or not cell-free virus, that means virus floating just around in the blood or in the liquid or in the semen or whatever, in the actual semen fluid, they dribbled what they call an SIV cell-free solution onto the tongues of rhesus macaques. 6 out of 7 of the macaques were systemically infected using this method. Now that is absolutely homologous with a vaccine, again cell-free, viruses, live, containing SIV. That's exactly analogous.
Okay.
So that's just SIV, but we do know that SIV infects human cells. So you think, well, wait a minute, how sensitive are human oral mucosal cells? And lo and behold, we find that in the case of HIV, it regularly infects or they used an experiment where they took a suspension of singular follicular dendritic tonsil cells, human ones, exposed them to HIV, cell-free HIV infection, and lo and behold, they infected the tonsil cells and the cells produced virus, and they were then able to reinfect lymphocytes using the virus. So if anything, the oral route is infinitely more sensitive and susceptible to infection, because when they used the same solution, they had to increase the viral titer by 6,000 times to achieve systemic infection rectally in the monkeys.
Okay. I have heard a criticism of Louis Pasteur's theory based on the idea that live polio vaccine was administered orally on sugar lumps, so that disposes of that criticism, doesn't it?
Well, if anything, it makes it even more viable.
Right, well, that's interesting.
It makes it even more valid to show that the oral route is 6,000 times more receptive than
the rectal route.
That's
what she said.
Yeah.
Assuming she got a...
Yeah, you see, I thought that when both the Lodell Vaccine Committee argued that it wouldn't be infectious orally, and subsequently, after Tom Curtis had written a piece in Rolling Stone, the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, who had developed a live poliovirus vaccine in the 1950s, felt stung into action. So they held an inquiry into whether or not this was a feasible theory. They again came up with the same argument, that oral SIV, even if it was cell-free in the vaccine and live, would not be infectious. But what Ruth Ruprecht has done since last June is completely... Nobody's taken this up, by the way. That if anything, the oral route of transmission... Of course...
You're saying it hasn't been cited, that's the usual...
No, it's never been cited. Mm. But you see, obviously she was wrong. I think she has got the cavil. It's wrong to extrapolate information from this. But you see, she's supposing that cell-free virus has ever been present in semen, and they've never found it. They've never found it. They've always had to. The customary way to do it is you get your semen samples, and I quote in my paper two experiments, one out of 20, one with 25 samples and another with, I think it's 95 samples. You get the semen from people with AIDS, gay men with AIDS. Mm. And you get semen samples from them. You strip the monocytes out of the semen, because there are monocytes present in semen. You then culture the monocytes very, very intensively, sometimes for several weeks. And sometimes you have to have 15 goes at it. And if you're very lucky, a little bit of virus will clink into the bucket at the end of the day. In the 1 in 25 experiment, the 25 semen samples experimented with, they found one provirus. In 25 semen samples. Mm. Now, one provirus is not an infectious dose.
What is your... It's not clear. I mean, this whole issue, of course, is full of...
So the whole thing... I mean, Ruth Ruprecht's theory does not prove that semen is an efficient method of transmitting cell-free virus. But my God, if you're using a cell-free SIV solution on monkeys, that's exactly the equivalent of SIV getting into the human bloodstream via oral mucosal cells.
They spray it on the back of the...
Sprays it on the back of the throat or on sugar cubes.
Why was it believed so definitively that viruses could not pass orally?
Because they assumed that retroviruses would remain in the alimentary tract. Because poliovirus itself is the specific kind of virus that it is. Not adenovirus. What is it? It's a stomach virus. It goes to the stomach.
Mm, it's really widespread, isn't it? It goes to drinking water and so on.
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, when I was a child and they had all the polio epidemics in Britain, all the swimming pools where I lived were closed, and there was massive outbreaks in... Now, where was it?
Well, I mean, it's true now.
Aberystwyth, I think, had a terrible polio vaccine scare. Poliovirus scare.
What is your... what are you concluding? That you're concluding that...
Well, first of all, that vaccines have...
Do you think that HIV... Do you think HIV exists in the first place?
Something exists, but whether it's a viable retrovirus, I don't know.
And it might be completely irrelevant. It may be that the SIV thing has been spread around by vaccination.
So the SIV thing has been spread around by vaccination.
But that may be irrelevant to
AIDS. It is a totally harmless passenger virus. It obeys all the four regular criteria for passenger virus, as Peter Duesberg explains in all his papers. That, you know, between infection and development of the disease, you just cannot predict when the disease will happen, if the disease will happen at all. I forget what the...
Right, so it's the sort of opposite of Koch's postulates.
No, he relies very heavily on Koch's postulates.
Yeah, but the four things we're saying are...
The equivalent of it, yes. In how you deem a virus to be either actively causing an infection, or is it just an opportunist taking advantage of a depleted immune system to come out of hiding and replicate, or what is it?
Okay, so it's exactly analogous to detecting any other thing which might be causing a disease.
Separating out. It's an innocent bystander.
So what are you saying? So you're saying that SIV is essentially not very important?
Well, SIV doesn't cause... You see, no lentivirus causes the destruction of its natural host's immune system.
Okay.
Lentiviruses are not sexually transmitted, characteristically. They are transmitted from female to offspring, either in utero or in breast milk.
Okay.
When the animals were falling sick with what was known as eventually as simian AIDS, SAIDS, it was because macaques were being infected by a virus that seemed to be carried either by African green monkeys or sooty mangabey monkeys. Both varieties of monkey have carrying SIV, which can cause macaques to get an AIDS-like illness. But there's a very important difference. One, that the illness is very rapid. They die within 8 months. There's no long incubation period. Mm-hmm. B, they get the disease before they've established a neutralising antibody response. But what made Peter Duisberg very suspicious about HIV and AIDS is the fact that HIV was initially thought to have an incubation period of 10 years of neutralising antibody, and then it causes a disease.
Well, that's not initial, that's after 10 years after they'd found it. The period was lengthened.
Well, it was what we always call the embarrassingly elastic immune, you know. Okay.
I thought it isn't up to about 15 or 20 years now.
Oh, it's up to about 30 now.
They push it up.
And, except, unless, of course, what nobody can explain is why the fact they've had to stretch the dormant phase or the, you know, latency phase, but at the same time, they're having to admit that when you start to give people AZT and the other so-called viral inhibitors, they develop AIDS within 2 years and die.
So, of course, that's true. I hadn't thought of anything.
So what happened to the missing 8 years, even if you go on a 10-year basis? Mm. Nobody seems to want to talk about that.
You haven't read Louis Pascal's name, but Louis
Pascal... No, I'm hoping to get it. Could you let me have a copy?
No problem.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
It's about 30 pages or something.
That would be wonderful.
There are about three things in it. One is the HeLa cells, which he regards as a great scandal, but that's for our purposes, that's a bit of an...
Well, I've always worried that, you see, when they're doing all these experiments and say, this proves conclusive that this virus, you think, well, wait a minute, what was present in the HeLa cells?
Well, that's right. I think I heard the other day from a virologist that they contain human papillomaviruses, and that's what makes them...
Well, yes, that's what makes them so aggressive. Yeah. But did you see the documentary about...
On TV, the BBC one.
Yes.
I thought they avoided the ethical issue, actually.
Well, they did, but it was fascinating to think that HeLa cells had even got as far as the Soviet Union. Closed doors in the Soviet Union.
Well, Pascal quotes from the book by Gold. Have you heard it? A Conspiracy of Cells, it's called.
Yes.
Very good book.
Yeah.
I photocopied
it. I didn't think the HeLa thing had too much to...
Well, I mean, the point that Pascal was making was that it was incredibly scandalous that all these labs were supplying kidney tissue or whatever.
Yeah.
And they knew perfectly well it was HeLa cells for years, you know.
Quite. Well, you see, when Hilary Koprowski sued, and I haven't mentioned this in my paper, but Hilary Koprowski sued Rolling Stone for the suggestion that as a developer of a live poliovirus vaccine, he might have been instrumental in SIV contaminants and causing AIDS and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, naturally, he had to defend his reputation.
So when they did the climb down, they...
That's when they did the climb down. And as Koprowski pointed out, and quite rightly so, when his vaccine was used in Poland, there appears to be virtually zero SIV. But what I'm saying is, Japan, of course, was the other big paradigm. You know, why is there HTLV-1 in Japan and no HIV, if my theory is correct? Because if my theory is correct, African greens carry both viruses.
Okay, so
but the Japanese also have a Japanese macaque which carries an HTLV 90% homologous. Now, if the Japanese made their own vaccines using the three and don't forget, 16 different countries make their own polio vaccines, but only two of them don't use monkey kidney cells, i.e. African green monkey cells, and they are the Razar Institute in Iran and Burroughs Wellcome in Britain. Now, nobody wants to go into the ethical issues of is it right to use human fetal cell lines, diploid cells, to make vaccines. But we won't go into that.
Yeah, I was just saying, the other thing about Pascal is that he believed the HIV theory, And therefore, from his point of view, it was scandalous that they should have done stuff.
Yeah, but you see, I go from the other angle. Right. If I'm right, and it's present probably in a dormant state, obviously in a dormant state, in equal proportions, males and females, worldwide, wherever the vaccine has been used, and you will find the highest percentage in the countries where vaccination has been compulsory, but it still only causes AIDS in gay men who do a hell of a lot of drugs, drug addicts who do a hell of a lot of drugs, haemophiliacs who are sick people anyway, and people who have a blood transfusion. 50% of the people who receive a major blood transfusion in the United States die within the year anyway. That's up to 60% within 3 years.
About this business about risk groups, and there's a friend of mine.
You cannot have a circumscribed epidemic. You see, if people presume that an epidemic can be restricted to certain groups of people, no. A genuine epidemic goes right the way through the general population and will find its way to the risk groups. But what they're saying is it started in the risk groups and is going to spread out to the rest of the population. In other words, water is going to flow uphill. Mm. It doesn't work like that.
Can I ask about the Asian people? There's a friend of mine who's a biochemist who spent all his work, he's British, he spent all his working life in America. And he had a partner who, I infer without going into it, was a receptive one. This bloke died of what's diagnosed as AIDS. I mean, I don't know what his treatment was or anything. And the chap told me, the biochemist told me, that he didn't do anything of this drugs business or anything.
No.
Is that consummate experience?
Yes, but was he completely faithful? The boy didn't do drugs.
Well... That's what this chap told me, so I did conclude that there is such a thing, a definite...
There is a horizontal spread, I see. I just don't believe in that.
You think he was being misled by his partner? It's quite possible, I just don't know.
You see, check whether drugs would also include poppers, because they just don't include poppers as a drug.
But also find out what
they're not considered to be drugs by gay men because they take them all the time.
No one dies from AIDS per se. They should find out what the particular illness or condition he
had.
You know, be more critical about, you know, what was the illness.
I take your point.
Is he positive, by the way?
I didn't ask him.
You see, another thing that nobody seems to want to concentrate on, and Eleni Eleopoulos in Perth, Western Australia, I don't know if you've heard of her work. But she points out that a sexually transmitted bug has to be bi-transitive. But if you're saying that it's 15 times more difficult for a woman to infect a man...
That's right, it's just changing direction.
How the hell does everybody infect everybody else?
Yes.
And I remember I was watching television one night, and all the people that they were talking to were admitted to being the passive partners in anal sex. And they were sitting there, and I was sitting there like this... you know, concentrating hard. And then suddenly I thought, well, wait a minute, if he's got it, where did he get it from? Now, obviously, there are no hard and fast rules. There are very few people who are wholly active.
I think there's the theory that covers that is, have you read Hodgkinson's stuff? I mean, I know you told me that he'd...
Well, we taught him most of what he knows.
Well, if not all his... His theory is that, which he got from an obscure corner of Eleopoulos, was that there is... that the HIV, the tests for HIV are just not reliable.
No, they're not. They're rubbish. You see, as I've said in my piece, they've admitted now that there's no such thing as a typical HIV isolate.
Right.
Every single one is different. Now, if you haven't got a gold standard HIV isolate, how the hell can you have a gold standard HIV test?
His point is that if cells are under stress in some way, that's supposed to mean they produce byproducts, including which... lots of proteins and stuff.
Yes, organelles and all sorts of stuff.
Well, that's right,
that
they show up. And these people think, oh, right, this is evidence of HIV.
Yeah.
But in fact, they're just natural byproducts of the breakdown.
Sure. Cells in the process of house clearance or whatever.
You see, if you've got the point about the anal sex is suppose sperm is immune suppressive, which is, makes sense, this is a theory.
Yeah.
That it's got clever tricks of penetrating cells.
Yeah.
And that therefore that would cause an immune thing. And so the donative partner. Yeah. Not show up positive.
Whereas
isn't that a possible theory?
Never says that. Yeah.
Well, yes, but where does the
receptive partners?
If it's the semen in the bloodstream, due to the torn rectal tissues, you know, the torn rectal mucosa. We know that semen is allergenic.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying that would.
Then why hasn't why has AIDS only started now?
Oh, that would explain the trouble.
I mean, rectal sex would have been banned 5,000 years ago.
But
for religious reasons.
Well, I don't know, it may be.
God said it was bad, but then God wasn't getting it. But there was no evidence to suggest it had to be banned because it was medically dangerous.
I don't know, it did occur to me that it's conceivable that there might have been kind of taboo on that ground?
Well, the Jewish taboos on food were thought up by very shrewd men that realised pork doesn't keep in hot climates, and seafood is dangerous anyway in a hot climate. So naturally they would, or shellfish or whatever it is, they're not allowed to, crustaceans, go off very quickly. So if they can say, yes, but God says you shouldn't eat these, that will convince people not to eat them.
Good idea. It occurred to me that there's a possibility, a possible objection to gay sex or
sodomy. Seems to have been... why did it only happen recently? Now, you could say, yes, but gay sex was never practiced in such an intensive form.
Well, that's why it was illegal and things, wasn't it?
Yes.
In South and Latin countries, apparently, a lot of women have rectal sex, and even in France, so this idea, why aren't more heterosexuals...
It's a contraceptive measure or something.
Yes, and particularly in Africa.
Yeah.
Actually, for that matter, a lot of Arab boys, aren't they?
And teenage American young girls, apparently.
But you see, what nobody's explained is, how does a heterosexual man who has never had sex with another man get HIV? Now, they're claiming... they're being infected by women, but where are these women? Mm-hmm. Why haven't prostitute women got AIDS?
So that's your criticism of the HIV theory?
The only prostitute women who have been found to be HIV positive, in a study carried out in New York, at least a quarter of them were HIV positive because they did crack. They had never injected drugs. They were all drug addicts, but a quarter of them had never injected.
But it's the drugs that make them show up positive anyway.
Well, it's the drugs that will reactivate a dormant SIV that they got in their polio vaccine.
That's nonsense. One possible explanation, but there's also a possible explanation of it stressing their system.
It's all that nonsense about clean needles. I mean, they're talking about what goes in the needle. It's all the
same. Oh, yes, I mean, you can take the argument that Eliopoulos...
Yeah, I accept all this.
Because Eleni and I had a long chat when we met in Amsterdam in 1992, and I was saying, well, I don't know quite how to explain what I mean, Eleni, but it's something like some sort of cellular epiphenomenon, which is being misinterpreted as a virus, but is just debris being shed by the cell in convenient little packages which look identical.
Yeah, that's well.
Like some sort of organelle or something.
I think you'll find this is slightly different, but there's a friend of mine, Hillman, who knew.
Is that the one with an E or without?
Hillman, Hillman.
Ah, no. The Hillman who discovered SV40 is Hillman.
Hillyman.
Yes, Hillman. Sweet and Hillman.
Oh, yeah. Right. This chap, as I know, a friend of mine, I only got into touch with him by accident, really. He's very obscure.
Yeah.
But he's very good, actually. Unfortunately, he's very compartmentalised, you know.
Yeah.
But he goes right to the root of all this stuff. He examines the techniques, which is the kind of stuff that's slowly bubbling to the surface. Your work and people like Hodgkinson.
Yeah.
Because, of course, if the stuff is, you're told, somebody goes off and has a test. It happens on TV all the time, you know. You get the results of your test. Nobody tells you what the test is or what they're doing.
No, only that, they seldom tell you, and Jo's just about to do her programme on Channel 4 to illustrate this point for dispatches, is that you can take a blood sample and split it between three different labs. You can get positive, negative and indeterminate same blood sample.
I was pleased you got that commission. That's good news, actually, isn't it?
Yeah.
So let me just ask, right, you accept there is an SIV thing and that it's spread around the vaccine.
There is an SIV thing, yes, because why are they finding the same constellation of proteins or similar constellations of proteins?
The reason I'm wording that in a vague way is because, or an evasive way, is because if you look at the two techniques of electron microscopy and protein analysis, they've both got, in my view, severe possibilities of errors, and so it might be that SIV is some kind of artifact as well, possibly.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Anyway.
But when you say, I wasn't aware until comparatively recently, when Alex pointed out to me, it's a great little research with Alex, the scanning electron microscope shows you the whole virus from the exterior. Whereas with the other ones, what do they call the other
transmission.
Ones?
Transmission.
Transmission, where you actually slice it in the transverse slices, will give you... the cut across which shows you the characteristic rod-shaped solidified core and all that.
If you look into this, there's a possibility of artifacts there. You can't be sure what you're looking at.
Even the man who invented the electron microscope warned of this, didn't he?
Yes. I
remember this came to my attention in about 86, 87, because they were just about to celebrate the 50th anniversary of it. Do you remember?
Of the electron
microscope. And somebody who said, even at the time that he invented it, whoever this man was, I can't even remember his name, had misgivings that what people were looking at, they would misinterpret and not realise they were looking at laboratory artifacts. They were not looking at a living
thing. I haven't heard... Where did you get that quotation from? I've never heard that expressed like
it
that.
It was in, one of those things like either The New Scientist or The Times or whatever, because the 50th anniversary was just about to be celebrated.
Because that's an unusually... They're very, usually very keen not to mention this kind of possibility.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You see, another thing that people tend to forget is whenever they see these very highly coloured Kodachrome photographs of the virus attacking a cell. Well, all electron micrographs are black and white.
Mm, that's right, yeah.
So they've obviously been colour enhanced. So you're looking at an artificially enhanced artifact.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, the point about artifacts is if you look at electron micrographs of famous ones, the tobacco mosaic thing, if you look at it, you get all these little tubes.
Yeah.
If you stop and think about it, if you had a random assortment of this stuff and you freeze it or put it into some aerodite and then chop it up, you should get cross sections like that.
Yeah.
You should get sort of diagonal ones and things.
Yeah.
But you never get that. You always get these sort of things, and it probably there's some artifactual element there.
Well, you see, when Geller was trying to argue that HIV was a type C virus like his other HTLVs, he wasted a year doing that.
Mm.
Now, whether he was doing that on the instructions of the American government or not, I don't know. My theory is, and this is pure conspiracy theory, so you can just dismiss it as you want don't let the lid off the vaccine thing. We'll go along with your HTLV-1 theory, and we won't say how you found it, but for Christ's sake, don't let the cat out of the bag about SIV. So he knew where the body was buried.
Because Sneed had this on a radio program, didn't she? This is how Lou Pascal got onto it.
Oh, really?
She broadcast it. It's mentioned in his paper.
Yeah, well, I went to actually meet her.
You hear of her?
Hmm?
And
I was contacted by a woman called Simone de la Rue. Are you off?
I'm going to go to the hospital
My love. Right, so I'll see you later.
Is that all right?
Yeah, fine.
I'll see you later. It's very interesting talking to you. I'll see you.
Yes, nice to meet you. Thank you.
This woman called Simone de la Rue runs an organisation called La Ligue pour la the League to get the to repeal the compulsory vaccination laws is what the thing is about.
Right, Sneed was anti-vaccination.
Was also anti-vaccination.
Yeah, right, yes.
One of the reasons that she gives being the SV40 thing. I used to have all Eva Lee Sneed's early papers prior to this huge book. Funny if she rang me just as that book was about to be published.
Right.
Well, she did it at her own expense and against enormous odds. Whenever she went to the reference library in San Antonio to find out anything about SV40, the pages had been neatly razor-bladed out. But she eventually managed to find it on databases, so she was on the computer database, so she was all right. But anyway, this Simone de la Rue organised a conference in Paris, it was a seminar one afternoon, and I went over to Paris for the weekend. And I met Eva Lee Sneed then, and we had a long... We went out and had dinner together afterwards, and we were having long chats. So she said, well, why are you interested in SV40? Do you think SV40 caused it? I said, no, but it is a very useful precedent to show how easily simian viruses infect human cells.
Mm.
And we know that... At this time, I wasn't aware of the Walter Kyle piece, because this was 88, and he didn't put that piece in The Lancet until 92.
Yeah.
The same year that... Gillen apologised for not putting Pascal's article in the Journal of Medical Ethics.
I hope I'm not... you've made a few comments on the sort of anti-vaccination idea.
Mm.
You also mentioned earlier about hepatitis apparently being introduced into vaccines or something, is that right?
Yes, during World War II...
And hepatitis is a viral thing, isn't it, too?
Well, I'm not sure whether hepatitis viruses are in fact viruses. I think they're dormant and something wakes them up. They're particles produced by sick livers... But do they get into you from outside replicate, or are they merely encouraging you to make what you've already got anyway?
You're saying the particles might be, for that matter, artifact. They might be breakdown products or something.
It could very well be. In other words, we're always identifying the product of the disease as the cause of the disease.
You're saying that...
Yellow fever vaccines that were manufactured, I think, using chick embryos, were administered to United States troops during World War II before they went out east. You know, with the fighting the Japanese thing. And many of them developed hepatitis B, and there were many fatalities.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. Then, of course, there was...
South America, too, wasn't yellow fever?
Yes.
Panama, that kind of thing.
Oh, the Panama Canal. That's why Walter Reed injected himself with the vaccine, to test himself, to see whether he'd actually got the answer to yellow fever vaccine. And without Walter Reed, you wouldn't have had the Panama Canal. That's the way they put it.
Oh, that's the famous... So it's like... Ross getting a mosquito to bite him and getting malaria.
Yes, that's right, yeah. The experiments on themselves, then the other case I cite in my paper is in 1976, the Centre for Disease Control They hadn't really got very much to do since the polio epidemic, so they kept looking for epidemics. I think the minimum, the smallest epidemic yet recorded, and I think it was even reported in The Lancet, was of two people. They're so anxious to find patterns.
That was that famous,
but anyway, during 76, they warned the American government that a swine flu epidemic was on its way.
Yes, right.
The American government voted, I think it was something like $130 million, and Park Davis, I always get them mixed up with Sotheby's Park Davis, but Park Davis was sent a virus to manufacture a vaccine against it. And in fact, they had been sent the wrong virus. They were sent a Shope virus, one presumes, right. A rabbit virus. They manufactured the vaccine. Thousands of people were injected, millions in fact, were given the vaccine, and thousands developed Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a paralytic disease.
Not very dissimilar to polio.
Not very similar, not entirely dissimilar to polio. And some of them, many of them died. Some of them, I think, are still...
Yes, I heard about that. There's a good account of that in Ellison. I don't know if everybody seems to have a low...
Oh, pain. Ellison, yes.
What is... Can I just...
Ellison is a poisonous little shit who stole all Peter Duisberg's research and then did the dirty on Peter.
Right, so that was the reason for...
Ellison is the original poison dwarf. He is Mr. Evil.
It's a shame, but his book was...
Well, he was
one,
very
it?
Bright. He his was book, very bright.
Is not his book a good one? Have you seen it?
Well, he's got some very good points, but you see, Peter has made all these points.
Oh, right.
About the pellagra thing and beriberi and... scurvy, which everybody perceived as infectious diseases,
right.
There again, clusters and compartmentalised.
Well, and SMON.
Risk
well.
Behaviour.
Right,
SMON was uncovered by Joan Shenton, by the way, you know all about
serious?
That.
No,
she and a Japanese lawyer, Eiichiro Totsuko, dug into the story and did it on British television. And I think eventually that the firm manufactured Entroviaform, or Clioquinol, had to pay out something like $220 million.
So that was hers. But
that was one of her investigative
journalists.
And
that preceded her AIDS compilation.
Oh, yes, yes.
So that was before Meditel, was it? It was under a different...
No, I think it was still Meditel.
No, I thought it had a complete...
And, you see, Meditel had been going for about 8 years by the time I joined them in 1986.
Well, she's better, she's more...
She's got a wonderful track record. Yeah. And she did all those food, fad and facts. Fad and fact.
Along with Skrabanek.
Yeah, that's right. And she pointed out that sugar is not all that harmful, and that saturated fats is a load of old rubbish, and all the currently held shibboleths and taboos are all based on wrong science. But anyway, I was absolutely hooked on the idea that vaccines are very dangerous and can actually cause illness. Even the illnesses they're meant to protect against. I tell you who's very good on the subject, George Bernard Shaw. His father, and I think he did, was it him, or just his father, Germany had compulsory smallpox vaccination after the reunification of Germany in about 1870-something.
Smallpox, it was compulsory in Britain in about 1850, wasn't it?
Yes.
Same sort of thing.
Yes, but in Germany they had compulsory smallpox vaccination introduced by Bismarck or whoever, the Iron Chancellor.
Sure.
And then they had a massive smallpox epidemic with over a million people infected. I think it was like something like 100,000 deaths, all in vaccinated people. So Bismarck is on record as that he's actually wrote a letter to the Reichstag saying this whole thing is a load of rubbish. Vaccination doesn't protect against
smallpox. There's a famous case in Britain, isn't there, where Lewis Carroll got involved and he wrote it, this business.
Oh, really? No, I didn't know anything about that one.
Well, it sounds
But George Bernard Shaw's father, I think, was touring Germany at the time and got it.
Oh, that's
and survived
got
it.
Smallpox.
Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting because I had no idea it was a German component. I mean, the version I've heard, which just keeps surfacing, is that the smallpox was made compulsory in Britain in 1850 or something, and there were continual epidemics after it of smallpox.
Yes. Yeah.
And then there was a famous case where Lewis Carroll wrote, somebody wrote to the paper saying that, look, 98% of people who've been vaccinated have got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lewis Carroll wrote and said, you haven't got the complete figures, you need to know the other lot as well.
Yes.
And then he left it there, he didn't...
Yeah, he didn't, follow through.
But,
but you see, also, it would depend on whether or not... The original smallpox vaccination, everybody knows the story of Jenner realising that milkmaids didn't get the disease and all that crap. But what, in fact, his initial remedy was, in fact, taken from horsepox. He twigged that it was the horsepox, particularly in the hooves of the horses, which contaminated the cattle. So they were the originating source. and his the disease that he took his exudates from was so disgusting it wasn't marketable, so they had to pretend it was vaccinia.
Oh, I see.
It was a switch cell.
Hmm. I mean, I take it.
Incidentally, that was the first man-made and man-engineered zoonosis.
Zoonosis, knowledge of...
No, zoonosis is the taking of a virus out of one species and putting it into another deliberately.
Okay.
Just as we presume BSC began by an accidental one, was man-made.
Oh, I'm leaning towards the organophosphates theory.
Oh, yes, well, I always have done. Okay. Why has nobody ever done an epidemiological map showing the highest incidence in Kent, wherever, Somerset particularly, of BSC and checked it out for organophosphate use?
Well, I think Purdy has. I think the farmer has. I think the math kind of avoids doing it because they don't want to establish any kind of connection. I'm pretty sure this Purdy chap has done that.
Yeah.
Judging
yeah.
by that. There's a friend of mine called Joanna Wheatley, who's an organic farmer in Maidenhead, who's got onto this as well. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, with all this Gulf War thing, organophosphate, well, I think that surely that's right. Going to cause
if
more
you look
comment.
At the supposed cause of prions here, this is a case where electron microscopy could be defective because they've got this little twiddly thing. Mm-hmm. But in my view, there's so much stuff you see under electron microscopy that I would suspect
Yes, I mean, the fact that we're seeing something new for the first time, saying, wow, look, folks. I mean, when they suddenly said that HIV was a new virus, I said, but is it? I mean, is it a virus at all? But if it is a virus, is it new? It's the new telescope, new star syndrome. The stronger telescopes you get, the more stars you'll see, but they're not new stars, it's the telescope that's new.
That's true. Actually, you get that with radiation. Actually, there's a chap I know who worked at Sellafield all his life, and he told me that, of course, he's not anti-nuclear power. He said that the problem with it is that it's so easy to detect radiation that people sort of see it everywhere.
Yeah, but the latest absurdity, and I'm not sure whether you're aware of David Resnick. Well, he and Duisberg wrote a book together, and Resnick is part of the Rethinking AIDS group in San Diego, and he went to a conference that was held in March, which is usually, they all agree that everything they hear at the conference will be sub rosa,
right.
Strictly off the record, but he couldn't wait to report to the Rethinking AIDS group. And you see, a lot. I don't know whether you know about the David Ho AIDS model.
Yeah.
Which is mathematically a load of garbage. When Serge Lang was confronted with the maths, he just said, take it away, I won't even read it. It's rubbish. I mean, the differential equations that they are using are totally wrong.
They use differential equations?
Mm.
You don't often see heavy maths in biology.
Well, the whole of the David Ho hypothesis, that the body is pumping out billions of viral particles per day, but in the early stages you're able to pump out billions of extra T4 cells to cope, and that the two mutually eat each other up and disappear with no trace whatsoever. I mean, it's like saying you can have the Battle of the Somme in a cornfield and never break a single stalk of corn. No bodies, no detritus, no spent cartridges, nothing.
Do you understand differential equations?
No, I don't. But apparently you've got to be aware of what your factors are before you can make an equation at all. So many of them are unknowns.
I thought one of the problems with that also was that he used polymerase chain reactions or something like that.
Well, you see, yes,
and you can't tell how much stuff was at the beginning or something.
Well, the secret of the polymerase chain thing is you get a probe and you say, this is the probe I'm going to use, and I'm going to look for this stretch of DNA, this stretch of RNA in that substance. And then the probe will replicate every time you double it. You know, you double it up. The probe will replicate and so will the target if it's there. But the problem is they replicate at different rates. So you cannot say, because the rate is not constant, you cannot say, if I start with 10 bits of probe, I should wind up with 60 bits of target.
It doubles each time. Why should you not have a...
Well, yes, but it gets out of step. So as Peter Duisberg and Harvey Bialy, the editor of Biotechnology, you know, Nature's sister paper in America, pointed out, they were out by factors of 60,000 or something. Something
that's
weird, and that when you adjusted the maths for that and took that into account,
right,
it would reduce it to something like between 1 and 1.5 viral particles per milliliter of blood, which is what it's always supposed to have been.
How much... Ho invented, he was famous for inventing the slogan, it's the virus stupid, wasn't he?
Yes, it's the virus stupid,
yeah. Is it fair to say that he's the first person in mainstream AIDS science, such as it is, to have been kind of received flak straight away?
Well, no, Gallo was the one who they went straight for. They went straight for his jugular, because he's such a woundingly unpleasant man. And, of course, it was very interesting. He had a very early run of luck with that HTLV-1 discovery, most of which the research had been done by the Japanese, and he nicked it. But having found HTLV-1 in a cancerous cell line, which, for all we know, was contaminated with helicase, how do we know? The tissues he was looking at were lymphoma tissues. So he called it HTLV-1, human T-cell lymphoma virus. Then the Japanese came up with their HTLV-1, which was identical, and both subsequently showed to be between 95 and 100% homologous to African green SIV, HTLV, STLV rather. But the Japanese correlated theirs with this rare form of adult T-cell leukemia. And so Gallo pragmatically changed his virus to human T-cell leukemia virus.
I just wonder there are thousands and thousands of diseases. How the hell did they manage to think of the idea of tracking down that particular one?
Well, I don't know. So how often, I said to Peter, do you find an orphan pathogen? You find something and say, does it cause anything? And then whoopee. He said, well, yes, if you accept correlation as proof of causation. But then, as I point, you know, we were talking about it, and he pointed out in one study by the Japanese of 600,000 people in the southern two islands of Japan, positive for antibodies to HTLV-1, they found, I think it was 339 cases of adult T-cell leukemia.
Oh, I see.
But it would have been virtually impossible to find anybody in that area with any disease who didn't have HTLV-1. So you could blame HTLV-1 for the whole lot. But they found about as many of adult T-cell leukemia who had no trace of HTLV-1 infection.
So it's complete bullshit.
It's complete bullshit. Not only that, had Gallo been right about that, you could have made several predictions, and this is what Peter first taught me. Because he's very patient, and he's not condescending or patronising or horrid, and yet he's one of the major experts. He taught me that if a hypothesis is correct, predictions based on the hypothesis will be fulfilled. Not one of the predictions about HIV has ever been fulfilled. But talking about HTLV-1, if it was the cause of adult T-cell leukemia, all cancers are monoclonal. They start from one cell that turns rogue, right? If the viral theory is correct, and the virus, when it infects a cell, integrates randomly, so it, say 100 viral particles infect 100 different cells, they will all integrate into a different place in the genome. If any of those result in cancer, then the cancers will be polyclonal. You'll have several different cells that have turned rogue, but they have never found a polyclonal adult T-cell leukemia. So it's not caused by a virus. Also, it would be the first case on record of a virus that was known to be sexually transmitted, of a cancer being an infectious disease sexually transmitted. They try to claim it for papillomavirus, but as the majority of people with papillomavirus don't have cervical cancer, and as the majority of people with cervical cancer don't have papillomavirus, there is a correlation between a certain amount, isn't there?
I don't know. I read Skrabanek on cervical cancer. He came up with, you know what I mean? He's got this disconcerting idea that it was widely believed that there was a sexual connection, like there was a nuns and prostitutes thing.
Oh, yes, yes.
And he says that's all bullshit, basically.
Then they were trying to suggest that the breast cancer might be an infectious disease. And I wanted to know what was the infectious rate of breast cancers in nuns who have just as high, if not higher, incidences of breast cancer. Because they've never fulfilled their function as mothers or lactated or whatever, you know, that would also seem to have some bearing on the situation.
There's nothing about vaccines. What doctors don't tell you had a evening meeting on it a few weeks ago, I don't know if you know this.
No.
It was taped. I wanted to get a tape of it, but I haven't. Addressed by the woman who runs it, whose name I've forgotten. I wonder if you had any. What are the objections to vaccines apart from? I mean, obviously, if it's got stuff in which is dangerous, that's an objection to it. But presumably, there is a genuine case for vaccines, is there not?
I would say not. In that, vaccines are concentrated on the very young who don't have a mature immune system. Now, this is just my theory, but I can't help thinking it may sound cold-blooded, but the childhood diseases are sent to separate the sheep from the goats. The sickly child will succumb to childhood diseases, but we have given them vaccines so that sickly children live to be sickly adults.
So you're saying that vaccines do
work? In other words, what vaccines do is They exaggerate the humoral arm of the immune system at the expense of the cellular one.
The humoral arm?
Yes, the one that produces the antibodies.
I would have thought... I mean, I don't...
In other words, they're training the body only ever to accept attenuated strains of anything. Mm. It never has to deal with a full-fledged disease. It never. It's never thrown in at the deep end. They always give it just little bits of stuff.
You seem to be accepting that they work, though.
Well, I'm saying that when you bombard children with, is it 8 or 10 now, childhood vaccines, you're giving them all those illnesses. Mm. Many of the children would never have encountered those illnesses anyway. I tell you what put me onto this. There was a doctor called Archie Kalikarinos in Australia who was charged with vaccinating the Aboriginal children with one of the triple vaccines. Mm. I forget which one it was. And they were dying like flies. Until he had the idea of giving them massive triple vitamin C booster shots before he gave them their vaccines. Then they didn't die in such great numbers. But in other words, they were giving them diseases that the Aboriginal immune systems were not trained to handle. You see, when you say the immune system is standard throughout the world and everybody can handle every disease thrown at it...
My position is it's not understood. I mean, I don't know.
So. Well, we still understand very little about the immune system. Yeah. You see, when the conquistadors went to the New World, they decimated the populations with influenza, measles, what have you.
And yet
the people in those countries had their own immune systems to protect them from their own endemic diseases, including the syphilis that they're alleged to have given us, which the people brought back, which ravaged Europe, if that's the story. I believe it was already here before they went.
I think it was, actually, as I've seen
archaeology. I mean, if ancient Romans and people had syphilis...
Yeah, I remember reading an archaeology magazine which had...
Yeah.
But, you know, because it does affect bones, doesn't it?
Mm.
Okay, well, I mean, this is getting off the point a bit, really.
No, I believe that SIV was just HIV. It is SHIV. HIV is SIV passage through human cells.
Okay.
Now, whether or not there's any degree of horizontal transmission, I think the jury's still out on that one.
Can I ask about the policy? I mean, Neville Hodgson phoned me yesterday, which was to touch base, as he said, because he's a nice chap. I like him, actually.
Yes, very nice.
I wish I could be as polite as him.
Yeah.
He always makes me feel very sort of gauche. And so.
Yes, I speak my mind. He's much more diplomatic.
He said he was invited to Colombia, to address a meeting, and he maintains that, which is perhaps true, that the Third World, or maybe the Spanish-speaking countries, will be the first to break ranks sufficiently, that Colombia will be the first country to...
Well, Spain is already saying that HIV doesn't even exist.
Oh, really?
On the front pages of their newspapers.
Oh, well, yeah, but that might not be an official line.
As a result of Stefan Lanka and various other people... Yes, but there is a groundswell there. I mean, they are beginning to notice that there are alternatives.
So the Spanish government is taking some...
Notice. Well, we don't know what the Spanish government will do. It depends how hand-in-glove they are with major pharmaceutical companies.
Fair enough. I just wonder... I mean, it's just that he was explicitly saying there's this meeting, this conference which he was invited to chair in Colombia, and he suspects that that'll be the first country.
But it's interesting that particularly in Spain and Italy, the AIDS epidemic seems to be drug-driven. It's mainly in their drug addicts.
I mean, is there less homosexuality in these places? I don't know.
Well, I think there must be. You see, wherever countries are that... I'm not quite sure how liberated Italy is, certainly not in the south of Italy and Sicily, where women are sequestered or overwatched, men will do it with each other.
Mm.
Spain, I'm not sure, you know, how often do they get past the Duenya? And if you can't get past the Duenya, do you go to Paco for a bit? You know, who knows? But, you see, they would rather admit to being... drug addicts than admit to being gay. There's less of a stigma attached.
You're saying it's like a...
So there might be,
an
homosexuality
of...
there.
Right.
On the other hand, we know there is a hell of a lot of drug addiction there. And incidentally, there was a thing at the beginning of May in a Japanese newspaper pointing out that although the trend in America appears to be that less people are getting AIDS and dying of it, it's on the wane.
Mm.
It's just the reverse in Japan.
Okay, you'd attribute that to the spread of
drugs. I'd attribute that to drug use. You see, when you say risk behaviour causes AIDS, blah, 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 the Japanese, even 10 years ago, were still a very conservative and very fastidious people.
When you say AIDS, you're talking about HIV positivity.
Talking about AIDS.
Right.
AIDS is a definite condition resulting from the depletion of the immune system and the collapse of the immune system. HIV is something else again. It's just another passenger on the
thinking ship. Yes, but what I mean is the traditional view, at least in Britain and America, is that if you test positive on these dubious tests, you'll then drugged with azotin on.
Yes, correct. But you see, don't you see the way they've worked the scam? In 1986-87, they were saying, but wait a minute, we're on a knife edge here. It's only a question of time before they realise that HIV isn't the cause of AIDS. What the fuck do we do about that? Well, we'll make sure we give the bastards a good shot of the drug that will give them AIDS and then say it was the virus that did it. You see, why else would they have cleared for takeoff in record quick time with all those dubious phase 2 trials and God knows what of AZT? They released for human consumption, lifelong human consumption, a form of chemotherapy that was rejected in the 1960s, even as a drug of last resort in acute cancer cases, because of its high toxicity. And then to recommend they stick it in babies and pregnant women? Are you aware of the results of the studies that were carried out on the babies born to pregnant women?
I'm sure they're very
with impressive. Polydactylism, multi-fingers and toes, holes in the heart, sometimes with whole organs missing. I mean, my God, it's creating havoc.
Yeah.
So it's all pretty scary stuff. But as long as the public have been hoodwinked into believing that HIV is the cause of AIDS, when Robert Galla was asked in, about 1985-86, I can't pinpoint the exact source, he was asked by, I think it was a gay researcher, what made you suspect that HIV, well, that AIDS was caused by a retrovirus? And his reply was weird. He said, we needed a focal point. I thought, well, any focal point. And retroviruses were the buzz word at that time. You know, everybody was into retroviruses. That was the gravy train to be on. Because they were going to be proved to be the cause of everything from verrucas to split ends. Of course, they'd never been proved to cause anything. They keep saying, oh, yes, but what about the animal models of equine infectious anemia and Mydivisna virus? The more you look into Mydivisna virus, the more the whole thing just falls apart. One of the world's leading AIDS bores at the moment, who's on the lecture circuit and, you know, earning a fortune as an AIDS expert, is a man called Ashley Harzer, who specialised in Mydivisna. He took over from the work of Sigurdsson and his colleagues in the 40s and 50s. And when you look into Mydivisna, which HIV was always compared to in the early days, genetically, structurally, it's quite the same. The particles look the same with the cone-shaped, you know, the conical hard core, whatever, capsid. You reveal some interesting things about Mydivisna. One, it's not known to be sexually transmitted. It's thought to be aerosol-vectored.
Mm.
Two, autopsy studies, biopsies, necropsy studies carried out on sheep who've died of Mydivisna infection show no trace of the immune system being damaged. Three, the Mydivisna is considered to be the same virus that causes two diseases, either a lung disease or a brain disease. And certainly until 1980, they'd only ever found one animal that had both. How can you have a virus that causes either or? You can have a virus like varicella zoster virus, which causes chickenpox the first time you get it. Then it stays in your bloodstream and will subsequently give you shingles. That's a virus that causes two diseases. But this one is an either or. You think, well, wait a minute, I just don't understand how that could work. They also showed in the Mydivisna experiments that sheep breast milk can infect the ewes. They can infect the lambs. It was a very clever study. It was very elegant, actually, very neat. They found 100 ewes who were Mydivisna positive, you know, infected with Mydivisna, all about to throw their lambs. They kept them all, you know, carefully under observation. And as and when they threw their lambs, 50 were taken away from their mothers immediately on birth. They weren't even allowed to lick them clean.
Mm.
And of the remaining 50, they were allowed to suckle for periods of up to 10 hours. And of the ones that were allowed to suckle, 27 out of 50 became positive for Mydivisna. Of the ones that weren't allowed to suckle at all, none of them was positive for
Mydivisna. So it's pretty similar to these mice.
Yeah.
Mice milk things.
Yeah.
With the 30s.
But another clincher for me about the HIV thing is when you look into the HIV literature and how it's supposed to be spread and whatever, how the hell did it get to the haemophiliacs? They claim it was because there was cell-free virus. It would have to be cell-free in factor VIII. You see, factor VIII is strained, is filtered through a, 100 nanometer filter, or is it, you know, even smaller than that? So that nothing as big as a cell. It would be like trying to, you know, put the dome of St. Paul's through a tea strainer. It wouldn't work. So they said it had to be a virus in that case. But as cell-free virus is never found in the bloodstream, or plasma, how did it get into the factor VIII? Not only that, but the Centre for Disease Control themselves admit that after drying of human blood, the virus is completely rendered ineffectual and is non-infectious. Now, factor VIII is made by cryoprecipitation.
So what's the official answer to that?
They don't know. They say, oh no, it must have been in the factor VIII, albeit in small quantities, but somebody who receives a lot of it has probably been reinfected and reinfected and reinfected. But there's just no evidence. They've ransacked stored batches of factor VIII made, you know, prior to the AIDS scare to try and find evidence of cell-free, viable, infectious particles. And the best they can come up with, I think one woman in one study, quoted by Eleni Meliopoulos, found what she identified as 2.5 atypical viral RNAs, whatever they may be, but they're certainly not infectious. Unless they're totally involved in their capsid with their envelope and the envelope studying glycoproteins, glycoprotein 120, they're not infectious. Mm. Now, oh, so Raznik, let me carry on with this Raznik thing at this conference.
Hey, do you want to nick one of your cigarettes?
Yes, oh, do, I'm sorry, I didn't know you smoked. I was sort of cowering in terror, waiting for you to say, get out of my sight, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yes, well, welcome to Leprosy Corner. Anyway, Raznik went to this conference and was determined to blow the gaff on the bêtise that came out of it. And it was found using, because I got sidetracked on the Ho model, you know, being mathematically total garbage, and as Carrie Mullis, the man who invented PCR, said, you cannot use it for quantitative purposes. Quantitative PCR is an oxymoron. Remember that, it's a very useful phrase.
Doesn't exactly trip off the tongue.
So. No, quite. But if the man who invented it says so, he should know. So anyway, he listened to all these lecturers giving their talks about, all based on the Ho model of people who had X 100,000 particles per milliliter and blah, blah, blah. And they admitted that on the particular model, that 99.2% of those viral particles in this high load were non-infectious. Mm. Okay? And they were dealing with one particular patient who had something like 600 odd thousand per milliliter, which is a very high number, except that you have millions in the case of hepatitis. Okay. So when he asked this man, what is the role of these non-infectious particles? The man said, well, they must be pathogenic. The non-infectious particles are pathogenic. And the whole room just sat there open-mouthed at this stupidity.
Mm.
You see, if the virus is going to infect, it's got to get through it's got to jump a lot of hurdles. One, retroviruses are notoriously unstable, and ergo, they have a very high failure rate. The majority of retroviral particles extruded from a cell, this is according to, you know, orthodox biology, are defective and cannot infect another cell, or even if they do infect another cell, they transcribe themselves wrongly so that by the time the double-stranded DNA clips into the genome, it can never be expressed again.
Quoting Duisberg infections.
I'm quoting Duisberg, I'm quoting everybody who talks about retroviruses. Okay. Now, they've noticed that HIV is notoriously unstable. You can get two different strains of HIV from different organs of the same person's body on the same day.
Yeah, of course, an alternative interpretation is that they're not actually extracting HIV at all.
No, quite. It would
be the Hodgkinson view.
But you see, taking the orthodox view that what they claim they are doing is kosher, you just say, well, sorry, folks, according to you, this virus is so unstable. They've also found out, for instance, that SIV in African greens is notoriously unstable. Now, if you take my theory and put notoriously unstable SIV into the human bloodstream, which will then become even more unstable because it's changed its host, you've got the hyper-mutability of HIV. Okay, so then they try to reassure us, and as I've said in my paper, that SIV cannot be the precursor. African green SIV cannot be the precursor of HIV because its genomic structure differs by more than 50%. You say, well, it's nonsense to compare these two. You can't compare two moving targets. There's no such thing as a standard HIV isolate. So how the hell what do you compare it? How can you compare it to anything? Not only that, you've now admitted that SIV itself is a moving target. so you can't compare the two. But if you accept my theory that taking SIV as your precursor and measuring it against HIV, the more it diverges away from it is merely an indication of how much longer it's been in the human bloodstream. So that people vaccinated from 1960 onwards, when their virus was first isolated, allegedly, in 1982, 83, they would have had it in their bloodstream for what, 25, 30 years? So it'll be infinitely different than SIV. Because every time it replicates, it changes.
Right.
And some of these guys who were in the very fast lane lifestyle, getting repeated doses of venereal diseases, you know, I interviewed a guy in San Francisco who admitted to me that he'd had gonorrhea 18 times in 1 year. I said, but are you sure they were all different infections? That the original one you got wasn't healed up and appeared still? He said, oh, no, they were all different. And he was almost proud of it.
Mm.
He was almost proud of it. Your STDs were a symbol of your gay liberation, you know.
Yes, that's what Neville told me. I'm sure that's right. I can understand the psychology of that.
Yeah.
I can understand the psychology, provided it's curable, or they think it's curable.
Well, precisely. I mean, we learned a lesson when I was a kid. Sweets came off ration. And so we went and bought all the sweets we could get. You know, those with the most pocket money were the sickest. And we gorged ourselves on the things, and we were violently sick. Because we had too much. But that taught us a lesson. Don't overdo it. But with gay liberation, whoopee, all the restraints were off. And it seems rather ironic that the first thing they should do with gay liberation is fuck each other to death.
What is, why didn't this happen with heterosexual sex? Perhaps I've missed
something. Well, I don't think AIDS happens with heterosexual sex anyway.
No, you don't think it was the psychology, but you see, as soon as a pill was invented, you might have expected there to be a huge outbreak of heterosexuals, but I don't think
Well, why isn't it? If HIV was floating about, why isn't it just as prevalent in the heterosexual community?
No, I'm just talking about the psychology of it, really. I just wonder what maybe.
I think possibly
maybe
because.
Gay, there's no reproductive
well, don't forget, males, heterosexual men, don't get as many opportunities for sex as gay men do.
You mean just on ordinary social grounds?
On ordinary social grounds, if they have to go to prostitute women, can they afford it? But you see, it's nothing for someone in San Francisco, New York, even in certain areas of London, if you go to these discos. I've never been to a gay disco, but there's somewhere called Heaven, and then this. All these places where they think nothing of having sex with six different men in a night.
Does that still happen?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Now, I was talking to someone the other day who was boasting that he went up to Hampstead Heath and was fucked by three different men.
Hmm. So why doesn't that happen heterosexually? Maybe it's just...
I think it's because... Perhaps it's
more inhibition
heterosexual
or something.
I don't think it's inhibition. I just think they have a better sense of proportion. They're not trying to prove anything, you see. They're not trying to live down a stigma or whatever.
I don't forget,
everybody's misled by the phrase gay pride. It isn't really, it's gay defiance.
Mm.
To be proud of who you are, if you are really proud of who you are, you do not make your sexual identity your chief defining characteristic. But that seems to be the only thing gay men are capable of. And I say this as a gay man.
Mm. What's your view of the politics? It does strike me as a comparison with Lysenkoism, which was ridiculed in the West, of course, but despite the fact that it was actually aired openly. You know, I mean, I think this is much worse. The impression I get is that the effects of this are much more...
Well, you see, it was very convenient that HIV should be the cause of AIDS. As Gallo said, it was a focal point. Everybody could... a lot of retrovirologists who'd been complete failures in cancer research in the 70s, and their labs were on the brink of closure because of all the money that had been wasted, suddenly got a new lease of life. You know, they got on the AIDS bandwagon, and that became a gravy train, and now the gravy train's hurtling in the wrong direction. Nobody's got the guts to pull the communication cord. Would you? If you've got three children at private schools, two cars, a huge mortgage, and a wife with a black belt in shopping, would you say, sorry, folks, we've all been wrong?
Black belt in shopping, is that your phrase? I heard that.
No.
That's a good phrase, isn't it?
Yeah, black belt in shopping, yeah. But
it's very depressing, isn't it?
You know, nobody's going to break ranks. I mean, remember what Wilfred Owen said: "None will break ranks, though nations trek from progress." I mean, he's using it in the context of war, but you know, you could apply it to AIDS as well. All the honest scientists admit privately, but will never go on record, as saying that Duisberg is right: that HIV is not the cause of AIDS; it's a harmless background passenger virus which was probably a contaminant right. in vaccines.
Do they extend that to, I mean, presumably, if they were sincere about AIDS, they would research into the immune system, wouldn't they?
What they should have been doing was looking at the immune system and how to reconstitute a damaged immune system. You do not do that by... Right, so where were we? Oh yes, Robert Root Bernstein, when I met him in 1990, was worried that we would do everything we could and completely obliterate HIV, and still we would have AIDS with us. You know, we won't have defeated AIDS, we'd have just defeated a harmless retrovirus.
It was long ago, isn't it?
Yeah! So, when, also, Rutnick asked a really embarrassing question for a guy at this in March in America. Where they were talking about the study group of... do you want me to carry on?
It's okay. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. I was just checking the buzzer.
He'd got this... they had a group of patients, I think it was only about 12, who were on the protease inhibitors, and their viral loads had shrunk to absolute zero. And Resnick wanted to know how the patients were doing. Yes, but what was the effect on the patients? You've measured their cells, nanoparticles... Isn't that interesting? Is it because it provides the best model, or they know very damn well that it was the original?
Well, according to Martin Walker's book, you know, UCL is dominated by, you know, this Rockefeller school of stuff. Have you read Martin?
Well, they're all the university are totally hand in double. They have to be. They're financially dependent on pharmaceutical companies. I mean, Wellcome runs virtually the whole world.
Do you think there'll be a... You know, my model is like it's a thalidomide case where distillers have still not acknowledged any.
And they gave them derisory sums.
That's right. Well, I think the same thing will happen because, I mean, on the face of it, if you think of number, if you assume that AZT has killed, say, 10,000 people,
yeah,
if they got $1 million each, I mean, that would be $10 billion, which is
well, quite. But if the, as I suspect, another reason the vaccine story will never come out. Is that if people sued the government because they know it, and this has already started. May I quote? Right at the end of my paper.
Somebody got legal aid, didn't she?
Oh, no, that's Sue Threkel, who's suing over the Factor VIII thing.
Is that still going on?
Yes. That's why this guy wants the AZT story. In February 1994, a civil suit was filed in the US federal court on behalf of a girl of 12 with no known risk factors, who tested positive for HIV in about 1992, claiming that she was infected with the human immunodeficiency virus by way of an FDA-approved live oral poliovirus vaccine she received on April the 9th, 1982, June the 25th, 1982, and August the 20th, 1982. That's the three doses you give to a six-month-old baby at two-month intervals, right? The live oral poliovirus vaccine was produced, tested and approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration pursuant to measures inconsistent with accepted standards of medical practice. The product was FDA approved despite the known presence of contaminants, including retroviruses such as HIV. In other words, SIV. By June 1985, Judge Ronald Hedges ruled that American Cyanamid, the manufacturer, had to allow the plaintiffs to test samples of their vaccines for HIV-1, despite the stated FDA misgivings that the vaccine could not have been contaminated. The results of the test were scheduled for November 1995, but I've got no more details than that.
Okay, so originally they refused to allow them to test them?
Well, they always say there isn't enough material. We only have a small amount of this reference vaccine left, and it would all be used up if you tested it. So what are they saving it for, a rainy day? It's pouring out there. But you see, They daren't allow this, because if the precedent is set, the lawsuits that would emerge from people vaccinated against polio would be more than any government's budget.
Well, you mentioned, did you not say there was a D-notice about this on the phone? Was that some?
Well, I suspect there might have been some sort of a D-notice slapped on the Sunday on the Times, because they shut up like a clam about the smallpox thing.
And that was
the World Health Organization got on to the editor of the Times straight away and said, look, what are you doing here? And yet the story was given to the Times by a disaffected former employee of the World Health Organization. So it had obviously been discussed in their hallowed precincts.
Mm. Have you read Walker's book, Dirty Medicine?
Yes.
Because, I mean, I don't know about him. I think also there's a connection with Bindman, actually, and because there's a woman called Lynn Bindman who's co-written a book on physiology. She works at UCL. You know, she's mm-hmm. a career academic.
Mm-hmm.
And she's married to one of the Bindman, you know, lawyers.
Yeah. And
Bindman also have some controlling thing in the way money is passed around for
medical research.
This is a different issue, really, for legal aid, you know.
Uh-huh.
So if you have trivial cases coming along, you finance both sides.
Yes.
And that gives money to sort of bodgers and bodgers and
Smithers
and Smithers.
Yeah.
But you don't, of course, you can cut out important cases, you know, you can just
sweep them under the floor.
And I think probably Campbell is involved with that. Because, I don't know if you're interested in this, I found a reference to the zircon thing. Let me just read it out. It's only from articles.
I must admit, I only glanced at Martin Walker's book, because if it's anything like him, he's so boring.
Is he?
He really is the most boring little man I've ever met.
Let me just tell you about zircon. It says here, the irony of the case is that zircon, the project was cancelled, was not really a closely guarded state secret. The position of the proposed satellite was filed by the Ministry of Defence at the International Communications Union, and so on. So I concluded that that Campbell was a kind of pseudo investigating there.
But Campbell's hands are not entirely clean.
Well, that's what I meant, yes.
Because, he just gives the impression of wanting to push AZT.
Mm.
And that's frightening. You see, originally, I don't know whether you've ever read any of John Lauritsen's books about the phony trials on AZT.
I'm aware that, according to Ellison here, he invented the whole, he was the origin of the whole anti-AIDS establishment thing. And I saw him,
Lauritsen?
Yeah, an owlish glass.
Yes, that's right, yes. Yeah. Well, if anything, I'm his equivalent in this country. But we got together, and he got me to a sheaf like that of photocopies of stuff under the American Freedom of Information Act.
Yep.
And guess who sent it to him? Martin Delaney of Project Inform, who is now the chief pusher of AZT on behalf of what Burroughs Weapons. So he sold out. Every man has his price.
Mm.
But when the actual guy who, now what do they call it? The toxicologist employed by the FDA to look at the known literature about AZT and make his recommendations as to whether or not the drug should be cleared for human takeoff for the treatment of AIDS, said on December the 29th, 1986, just before New Year's Day, 1987, he could not recommend the use of the drug.
Mm.
Because they hadn't got any results of the animal studies, the long-term animal trials. They didn't know what the result of of using AZT would be. They ignored him and fast-tracked it immediately.
You know, there's a whole panic in the press and TV and so on. How much of that do you think was kind of genuine panic? I mean, how many people really believed that there was going to be a huge epidemic?
I think most people by then.
Mm.
Also, they were using the haemophiliacs as a sort of hearts and flowers thing to fast-track it anyway. And, of course, the haemophiliacs were the first unlucky people to be given it as a special, on special compassionate grounds.
That's right, there was this famous case of these gays demonstrating to be given AZT.
Oh yes, we had that in our film. Where they got smoke bombs and
really extraordinary,
God knows what, storming the NIH.
And it makes it look as though at any time, a scare can be invented.
Oh yes, we had Celia Farber, the journalist from Spin magazine, on our programme. I interviewed her. And she was talking about ACT UP, who had been, you know, responsible for the fast release of AZT. They had nagged them into releasing it early, because they want anything you can shove into them to get rid of AIDS. By the time we did our programme, she was saying that all those heavy activists on behalf of, you know, getting AZT started to take it themselves, and they started to get more and more sick. So a year later, they're all saying, my God, it's hopeless. What are they going to demand be released next? I mean, there was this thing, AL-721, this drug that was made from lecithins. And it was in the proportions of 7 to 2 to 1 from egg yolks or something, which was pioneered in Israel or somewhere, and somebody had bought the rights to it and they couldn't release it. Either way, it didn't do any good anyway. And apparently it was supposed to have made the virus much less likely to infect cells. Then there was this thing about cucumbers, then shiitake mushrooms, then typhoid vaccine. I mean, when you consider... Do you remember what Robert Geller was asked? Does HIV need a cofactor? Is there a cofactor involved? And he says, if you're hit by a truck, who needs a cofactor? So HIV is a truck, right? I start my piece off by saying the only cofactor necessary for HIV to cause AIDS is gullibility.
If I remember, there was a thing about Ebola fever, wasn't there? Did you ever look into that?
And what were the what were they experimenting with? It started in Marburg, and what were they looking into? African green monkeys. You see, I'm very dubious about this whole filovirus thing. Ergonomically, it doesn't work. If you look at the filoviruses they show you on electron micrographs, they look like a map of the London Underground with different little prongs and lines and offshoots and roots and all sorts of stuff.
That's not interesting.
Now, a virus has got to be a compact, ball-shaped organism.
Can I show you an interesting artifact about this?
Yeah.
Briefly, I don't go into great length, but you quite often see, there are several related ones. For example, I'll illustrate with a bacterium. You sometimes see a bacterium, sort of roughly like
that. Yeah.
And it's got a whole lot of, you know what I mean? Discs of lines of stuff coming out.
Oh yes, I forget what the technical name for that is.
And there's a whole lot of lore about them being plasmids or something. The point I'm getting at is that if you had it in real life, imagine you've got a bacterium and it's got this stuff coming out of it.
Yeah.
If you then slice it down the middle, what is the probability of your slice exactly cutting through all this?
All those other bits.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
The thing is artifactually generated at the moment of cutting. So. Okay, you sort of mean that's a geometrical artifact.
Yeah.
It's very characteristic of a certain type of electron microscopy, and most electron microscopists and their interpreters have never thought of that.
No. Well, this is the way Geller was wrong about.
If you've got a funny sort of virus, and it's linear, remember that it's meant to be 3D.
Yeah.
And it's possibly the thing is when it's put under the electron microscope, there's intense beams of thing gets heated up a lot. It's probably caused by heating or something.
Yeah, sure. But when Geller did his transmission electron micrographs of HTLV3, he managed to produce one that had got just one blob in it that he sliced endwise. So it appeared to have a circular, a spherical capsid. He hadn't cut it transversely to show the conical shape.
Right.
But when you saw a wider scale one with the transverse things, you've got round ones and long ones. So that was wrong. Oh, another interesting thing. The first time I ever saw, it was a particular image which is frequently found in big colour blow-ups that people have on their, all the AIDS experts have got it on their wall, taken by some, I think it was a Norwegian, and they were published as a series of photographs in National Geographic magazine in June 1986. And it's a big white blobby amorphous blob, a human lymphocyte, under attack by the AIDS virus.
Right.
And they'd coloured the AIDS virus blue, and they admit we have coloured these blue for ease of identification. So this is the virus attacking the cell, right? Exactly the same picture was reproduced in Scientific American, or was it New Scientist, 6 months later, only this time they turn it through 90 degrees, so it's a long wise, and they've said AIDS virus pouring out of an infected cell. So is it going out, or is it coming in? Nobody knows. Has the cell got revolving doors? We don't know.
That's a good point, yes. That's good.
They literally don't know how to interpret what they're seeing. And how do we know those dots were HIV?
Absolutely right. That's a good point. There's another... I don't know if you... This geometrical argument is perhaps new to you, so maybe I shouldn't go on about it. But you get a similar thing where you have this kind of arrangement, and you've got a similar problem. You see, if you had a lot of particles in a suspension, and you then... I mean, it's possibly different if you spread it thin over a layer, but if you've got an organ with a whole lot of particles, what is the probability of them all lining up for you obligingly?
Absolutely, in a completely flat plane for you to do a transverse slice, all with the showing the same
thing. That's right. It's probably caused by the electron microscopy, the heat generated is so intense you get little bubbles, you see.
Yes.
So that's another
artifact. Don't they have to coat it with a very thin 1 micron layer of gold? Or
yeah, they coat something. It with heavy metal. If you don't use heavy metal, the electrons just go straight through. So there's a possible artifact caused by irregular deposition, because nobody really knows. It's very hard to test whether with small... I mean, if you've got a strand of DNA or something, I mean, who knows whether gold actually sticks to it.
Yes, quite.
And people don't—they don't test these things. They're not very thorough in their method. And of course, as long as you've got a little isolated subgroup who can do the testing, it's like with carbon-14 or things. If you've got a little lab doing the stuff, it's very difficult for external people to have any proper validation procedure.
You know, this seems to be an increasing problem with modern science: is they start an experiment with a predetermined result. And will actually distort it to give them the result they want.
Yep, I think that's right.
Whereas in the olden times, scientists were just people who observed things and then tried to explain why they happened.
This
empirical observation, as opposed to prior deliberation and determination and wishful thinking.
I suspect the same thing is true in nuclear physics, actually.
Yeah.
When you have these bloody great big cyclotrons and things, there's a huge electric charges and so on. I think a lot of the stuff they think they see could be saw an article claiming they were artifacts, although the bloke would not talk to me, unfortunately. I couldn't get you know, I think there are artifacts there as well, because I'm looking at things. It's partly because of the small size of it. You've got these things which are so tiny, very difficult to get into your hands. It's much different from, I mean, if you're looking at a plant or something, your senses are actually work.
But you see, as Eleni explained to me, whenever you see these micrographs purporting to show HIV particles, they are invariably the result of culturing. You can never take a straight blood sample or a straight semen sample or anything and blow it up and actually see the same thing.
That's right, it's a very elaborate process. Yeah, it goes through
so in other words, so it's an artifact. I mean, who was it observed? A culture we disturb. Even a culture itself is an artifact.
Yes, that's right.
Because you've only got the actual cell there with no trace of an immune system. Evelise Neal explained this to me. She said, yes, but Michael, if they're open on a Petri dish, they should be in the dark. They should be surrounded by all over pressure in exactly the same way that things in the body would be, moving, constantly moving about, or in a state of flux. You would have all the other cells and all the other bits and pieces, you know, that are contiguous in a in vivo situation. She said it's a very artificial situation just to have a flat film of cells completely devoid of anything else and fed with an artificial nutrient.
That is true. I haven't occurred to me that there's an in vitro stuff, there's that artifactual element to it.
Yes. Oh, in vitro, it's totally artifactual.
It's fair enough. With
The only thing that resembles it is the fact that you keep it at 98.4.
Yeah, when the medium is essentially similar to what you get in,
essentially similar, like that. Except that if you are using, say you're using fetal calf serum as the nutrient, are you absolutely sure your fetal calf serum hasn't got any one of the bovine retroviruses in it?
That's a fair point. Is that her...
This was somebody else mentioned, the fact that big laboratories buy their fetal calf serum in batches of 600 or is it 800 litres per batch, and they siphon off the amount they intend to use and pasteurise it there and then. But it doesn't come from the manufacturers already cleaned up. So if you haven't successfully done it, and I quoted my book, a guy who's commenting on the refusal of the government to allow xenotransplants. Remember that earlier this year they said no. Pointing out that even when you've subjected the animal sera to radiation and irradiation and whatever the other is, viruses can survive. So fetal calf serum could be up the bucket and with contaminants. Don't forget horse serum is used in the manufacture of tetanus vaccines.
Okay. I'll tell you a point about contaminants, but I don't know if you've got this point from Eva Sneed, but... What was she kind of saying about in vitro, apart from the positive contamination? She was just talking about the growth of the things being unnatural.
Well, no, I don't think she went into... She didn't go into any great detail in the bit I had, because I only had a 40-page resume of her theory about SV40. But what she had dug out was, contrary to what the monograph number 29 said, and this was the report on the proceedings that were held in 1967 by all the vaccine manufacturers, had SV40 caused cancer or not, she had managed to dig up some obscure paper by a couple of lady doctors in Oxfordshire who had noticed an increase in infantile leukemia since the introduction of polio vaccines. What would have been the contaminated polio vaccines? But all those were sort of quietly buried. But I found subsequent, in that stack of papers there, I've got references to the fact that the vaccine community were shocked to the marrow bone when Sweet and Hillman came up with the SV40 thing, because by then millions of people had already had both the Salk and Sabin vaccines.
Right. Right, the source for that is in a paper, a scientific paper.
What was that?
Well, the shock that they...
Well, no, it's just journalists who had talked to people at the NIH at the time.
Okay, because it's not the sort of thing that normally would surface in a paper, is it? They wouldn't.
Well, they all expressed their concern in 1967 at this big conference, because it's all there in verbatim in monograph number 29 published by the NIH. That's monograph 29, published by the NIH, December 1968.
Okay.
Took them over a year to get the monograph prepared.
Change the subject, when I remembered it, about there was a theory that Edison had taken up, particularly seriously, about Pasteur being a plagiarist of somebody called Bechand.
Yes, Antoine Bechand, yeah. Right. Well, you see, Bechand had always argued, and it was something that I'd arrived at independently, and I mentioned it to Peter Jusbeck. I said, are any pathogens pathogenic per se, or does the susceptibility of the host give the pathogenicity to the organism? How much is susceptibility of the host? How much is it inherent pathogenicity? So he said, explain yourself.
You translate that, yeah, give an example.
I said, well, how do you explain a case like Typhoid Mary, who herself carried the typhoid bacillus or whatever it is, managed to infect over 1,000 people, but never caught the disease herself? Why wasn't it pathogenic to her? So, Bechand's theory was that, in part, that the susceptibility of the patient will work in cahoots with the inherent pathogenicity of the organism. For instance, a sickly person getting a weak strain of we'll take these old people who are all dying of this E. coli stuff or whatever it is they're getting. What is it at the moment?
I don't know.
Not listeria, E. coli?
Salmonella?
No, there's this E. coli thing that's going around in Scotland. Stomach bugs. But old people in their 80s are dying like flies. Mm. Other people who get it recover. So the old people are much more susceptible, obviously, because they have a down immune system. But what, and Bechand doesn't seem to have appreciated that, but according to Bechand, a subsequent reporter, when Pasteur was dying, he admitted that Bechand was right by saying he was right, the seed is more important than the soil. No, the soil is more important than the seed.
Well, it's a slightly different issue. I got the impression that Pasteur had actually plagiarised Bechand's work.
Well, I wouldn't be at all surprised, because...
Oh, right, because...
And Pasteur was a flagrant cheater when it came to his experiments
How do you know?
The animals that he vaccinated against anthrax, etc., wasn't it most of them died, or some of them he fiddled the results?
It wouldn't surprise me.
He got the right answer, but for the wrong reasons.
I think there was the point about the patient was that there was a book written in about 1920, which I think...
Oh, yes, by a woman.
That's right. Yeah. I think Edison presumably was leaning on...
Oh.
There was a similar thing with Wallace and Darwin that he...
Yeah.
Anyway, that's
no, but it was the attempts to show that Pasteur didn't get it wholly right with the germ theory of disease.
Right, okay.
It didn't explain silent carriers, and also it sent the epidemiologists off on the wrong track, because they all started looking for transmissible agents, even in clusters of the disease which were obviously not. See, I think, doesn't Ellison explain that the one of the first things that should tell you that a disease is not infectious is that nursing staff, who cannot be protected from it because they don't even know what it is, never get it.
Mm. That happens with leprosy, doesn't it?
It happens with leprosy, it happened in all the cases of pellagra, which was considered to be violently contagious, scurvy, beriberi. Sailors were thrown overboard when they had it, in case they gave it to the other men.
Did you read a book by Youngson and Schott?
No.
Came out last year, very good. Well, it doesn't have references, it's journalistic, but there's a very good account of scurvy, which I hadn't kind of realised the full... kind of horror of it, that they estimated about 1 million sailors had died of it, and even when it was known, you're presented with the idea that as soon as they discovered this stuff about lemon juice or lime juice, that it was immediately introduced, but that's not the case. It took the chap years and years. It was only introduced posthumously after the experimental discovery.
Oh yes. Well, it was the same with pellagra, and the guy who came up with the true answer, Goldberger or Gold something or other, had warned them very early on that it wasn't caused by a virus, and yet they had X different viruses, God knows how many different bacteria, all of which were alleged to cause pellagra. He was saying, no, it's a vitamin deficiency, and what they were lacking was niacin, because they didn't know how to prepare the maize. And funnily enough, just as I was getting interested in this, they showed us a wonderful documentary about the Night of the Dead in Mexico, you know, where they prepare this very elaborate feast for the spirits of the dead the following day, on All Saints Day, whenever it is. And you saw this woman carefully soaking the maize, you know, the big ears of corn, like sweet corn stuff, in an alkaline solution the night before.
Lime,
to slake it and to bring the niacin out. But you see, the conquistadors who found the maize and took it back to Europe as a staple crop never bothered to ask the locals how you prepare it to eat it. And it never dawned on anybody that, you know, it was the staple diet of the Mexicans, so they obviously knew how to prepare it.
Again, of course that's,
and it didn't translate to Europe, because they didn't know how to prepare it.
Well, you're not talking about Europe, you're talking about, pellagra was the thing in the deep south, wasn't it? That must have been
and Europe. It was found very heavily in Italy in the 18th century.
Was it really? Yeah. Like polenta, didn't they? I think that's maize-based.
Yes.
Horrible
stuff. And people who lived exclusively on maize and didn't have all the other nutrients and stuff they needed developed this disease, which was, pellagra, rough skin, and frequently died.
That's right. In fact, of course, it's a notorious thing with deficiency disease. They tend to be the parts which are difficult to get to, like the skin and...
Yeah. So, and one of the first things that this Goldberger, or whatever his name was, noticed was that nobody nursing pellagra ever got pellagra.
Do you have any views on leprosy? I mean, this is completely irrelevant.
I don't know very much about it, except that it isn't contagious. God knows how it is caused. It's caused by a mycobacterium, isn't it?
It's believed to be, but I did wonder whether it's not just a deficiency disease, because you've got this business where all the nurses... It's an ideal do-gooders disease, you know?
Yes.
You go out there and you sort of swan around like the Africans.
Yeah.
You eat your own food and they kind of...
Yeah.
And they have it for years and years, you know. And,
yes, it could very well be. Would a vitamin deficiency literally eat away organs?
It doesn't eat. As I understand it, you know, you see these people with stumps and arms, but it's not caused by. They don't drop off. What happens is you end up with no feeling in your fingers. So, if you've got a fire, you just stick your hand in, you can't feel.
Oh, I see. So it's an accidental loss of limb. They don't just wither away.
That's right. And that would be consistent with a vitamin deficiency, because you've got the same symptom of.
Yeah.
At the superficial, right on the edge.
So it causes like a peripheral neuropathy.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
It could be like something like manganese deficiency or something really obscure.
Could be, yeah. But why do they claim that armadillos carry something that
you're supposed to be able to. You see, that's just another symptom.
An extract from armadillos.
You're supposed to be able to only culture the bacteria in.
In the blood of armadillos or something.
Well, that's another thing. So if you've got something with very obscure things like that, in my view, it just shows that they don't really know what they're doing. And they've got this.
Even today, they can't culture hepatitis B, any of the hepatitis viruses, and they can't culture the syphilitic spirochete either.
What do you think of the... You must have a view on this, the sort of politics of it. You've got all these dissidents, and yet it can hardly be... They're not very efficient at their job, are they? I mean...
Well,
despite all, but maybe that's
you see, they always run up against a brick wall of political correctness. No, the reason the CDC and the NIH and all the powers that be that wanted to create an epidemic so they'd all have a job, it all played into their hands that they had first called AIDS GRID, you know, gay-related immune deficiency. Yeah. That was a red rag to the... gay liberation movement. You say, you know, that we are being victimized, blah blah blah, and so the government immediately changed tack and decided it was everybody's problem and it wasn't just a thing for gay men, just to keep the gay lobby happy. But at the same time, the gay lobby will not admit that they might have done something to contribute to their own disease condition.
Yeah, right.
Oh no, we were just gay men exercising our options to have wild unprotected sex. And you see, the question of protection or otherwise didn't come up. And since the advent of antibiotics, everybody had become so blasé about sexually transmitted diseases, they were just regarded as a rather tiresome recreational hazard.
That's right, sort of Caton. So have you had anything to do with Caton?
No.
You probably haven't missed much, I mean, I don't think. That's right, he was going... Yes, that's right, they thought they had specifics in the medicine cabinets and so on.
Oh yes, and I talked to people in San Francisco when I was researching for the other AIDS programs, who quite willingly admitted that they used to take a handful of antibiotics before they went to the bathhouse. So they would already have the antibiotics in case they got anything. And there was one guy who was taking tetracycline for 13 years to protect his complexion because he was a male model.
Mm.
I mean, nobody knows what the long-term effects of over-abuse of antibiotics may be, but certainly it seems to have had the effect of, because they now recommend, you know, you can get a prescription for antibiotics for a hangnail, we've now bred superbugs which can outwit the antibiotics.
Mm.
When Joan and I were interviewing Luc Montagnier at the Pasteur in 1990, I always remember it was April the 10th, it was the day my mother died.
Did you do the interviewing? I mean, you're the...
Yes.
Right. And your voice was not on the tape, I presume?
Well, they cut my voice out from asking the questions, but
right.
We got his answers and then I did the voiceover.
Okay. Oh, right.
But we asked him what the Pasteur were doing at that time, you know, vis-à-vis AIDS, and he said there were two lines of approach. One, they were researching the possibilities of a vaccine, but in his opinion that a vaccine was not a viable option. But what they were doing was developing ever more and more powerful antibiotics.
Hmm.
So, you know, what is AIDS? Certainly there is an illness which is striking gay men, but when you look at it, the symptoms are identical to drug addicts.
Except in the case of this friend of mine.
And also the KS. You see, the drug addicts aren't getting KS.
Oh, yeah, you accept the poppers thing, do you presume?
Well, yes, I do.
Does everybody, or is that still a fringe thing?
Well, no, the gay men will not admit that poppers were the cause of KS. But they've only ever found, I think it was one case in a haemophiliac who was gay and used poppers.
Right.
All the rest are limited to...
Are they still on wide sale, I believe?
Oh, yes. They're banned in all 50 of the United States, but all they did was change the formula, and they're now marketed as video head cleaners, leather polish, or, you know, leather food, or whatever. They just changed the name of the use.
Is there a giveaway name? Is it called sort of, you know, Butch?
Leather? Oh, they're all still called Butch and Gold and Orgasm and whatever, you know.
I thought it was room cleaners. I didn't know they'd...
They sold them originally as room odorizers.
Yes.
You know, like those Mary Chess perfume things you can burn on a light bulb.
Oh, right.
But who the hell would want to make their room smell like a sort of pair of sweaty socks? I mean,
I don't know what these things are like.
Well, apparently they're supposed to be absolutely acrid, like rotten eggs or something.
Have you tried them?
No.
Not even once?
No.
I remember my brother told me that somebody new tried them and it makes your heart beat very fast.
Well, apparently that's what it was used for, as a vasodilator for people with angina.
Yes, that's right. It's
supposed to be. I remember having a long talk with Rube Bernstein, because he'd done an extensive study into Maurice Kaposi, who discovered, you know, named Kaposi's sarcoma.
Mm.
And I said, who was he? And tell me all about him. So apparently he was a dermatologist, and he married the boss's daughter. He changed his name, because he was Jewish, to the name of his home village, which was Kaposi in Hungary. And he had been sent these patients, they'd been referred to him, because they'd all been being treated for different things. Many of them had been treated for syphilis, but they weren't all syphilitics. It was a 12-year-old girl, several men in their 20s. It wasn't all elderly Jewish men of Eastern Mediterranean origin, as the legend grew. So I said, was there a unifying factor? He said, well, not as far as I can tell. I said, it wouldn't have been angina, would it? He said, why do you say that? Well, I said, a 12-year-old girl who might have had rheumatic fever, that can result in angina. Angina is one of the three principles of syphilis, because of the bug actually attacks the tissues of the heart, blah blah. I said, if what united them was the fact they were all angina patients, and the first ever angina patients to be given poppers, because they started to use them, that's why they were called poppers. They found out the vasodilator qualities in 1850 something in America, and by the 1860s they came into use to treat angina, and they were sold in little spherical glass ampoules wrapped in a net that you snapped between your finger and thumb. And as Vienna was very, very far ahead of its time, you know, medicine-wise, they had the greatest doctors and whatever, were they angina patients who'd been testing poppers, using poppers for their angina?
That's a very ingenious deduction, I
see. It's stretching everything to the absolute limits, But what else would unite a 12-year-old girl?
Very clever to do, get to reply to this.
He said, well, I'll look into it. I never heard another word, of course.
That's
but if we can show that poppers were in use in Vienna in the 1860s, you see, don't forget, he didn't publish his paper until, when was it, 1872?
Would that have been the same? I mean, there are various different forms like that. I think amyl nitrite was the original, wasn't it?
Amyl was the original,
there's
yes.
There's also butyl, isn't
it? Yes.
I mean, I think that recently some chap got a Nobel Prize for working out the function of nitric oxide, didn't he? It's the same kind of thing.
What, and the same sort of thing for causing nitrosamines and all that sort of stuff?
I don't know the details.
Because you know who one of the leading manufacturers of amyl nitrite was for the treatment of angina?
No idea.
Your friend and my friend, Burroughs Welcome.
Really?
Mm-hmm. But of course now they've all been superseded by other vasodilatory drugs.
They're supposed to also have the effect of anally dilating, aren't they?
That's right.
I'm quite sure that's supposed
and, well, it's a muscle relaxant or something.
Hmm.
What was it? There is only, I think, one standard use for amyl nitrite at the moment, and that's to treat a dose of strychnine. It's an antidote to strychnine poisoning.
Hmm.
That must be
empirical, mustn't it? I think nobody knows. I don't think.
Well, quite. But I mean, how would I think the thing, because of what it did, it has the effect of causing mesothelioma.
Mm.
All the blood, red blood cells turn brown and don't convey oxygen anymore.
It's possible that Kaposi's sarcoma is purely a man-made thing.
Well, yes, and don't forget, it's not even regarded as a cancer. So it was wrong to call it sarcoma, because it's never been proved to be an actual cancer. They tried to link it to HIV, but they've never found HIV in any of the lesions.
Is it cancerous? It just wants to do.
It seems to grow and form these nasty sort of blotchy type things. Some people describe them as purple. Some people describe them as brown.
Mm.
That's when they appear on the skin. But of course, they can be internalized in the lungs, particularly the lungs. And where else do inhaled substances go? You notice a lot of them get them around the nose and mouth area.
I presume you get them internally in the
Yes, and orally. And but the interesting thing, when they tried to compare it with the KS, which was associated with lesions that appeared on people who'd had an organ transplant and had their immune system deliberately lowered or cut off so that they won't reject the organ, they too developed a form of KS. But once they were put back on, once they withdrew the immune modulators or immune system restrictors, the things just disappeared.
An interesting point about that is, of course, I put this question on the internet, since the immune system is not understood, how is it possible to design drugs to suppress immunity?
Well, precisely. You see, everybody made the assumptions in 1981, 82, 83, when AIDS first appeared, that they knew about the immune system. There's this arm, and there's this arm, and this interacts with that, and the T4 cells alert the T8 cells to go out and kill the so-and-sos, and then the suppressor cells come and stop the TH because they're going too far, and blah, blah, blah. I thought, well, wait a minute, it was only in its infancy. I think there was only one person, was it Ruth Bernstein, who was honest enough to say that until 20 years prior to AIDS, the immune system had been the poor relation, microbiologically. That was the one nobody seemed to want to know about.
Yeah, I think it must be another victim of uncontrolled experiments.
Quite. And then getting back to my theory that kind of recently discovered human retrovirus that's alleged to have been in the human bloodstream for thousands of years, wait to cause a disease until all the right technical equipment is there. I mean, another thing that fits in with this is, prior to 1980, cell counts could be done, but they were extremely laborious, and they didn't seem to bear much weight in a situation. You know, they would only be done as a very last resort. Because they had to be done, you had to break the blood sample down under electron microscopy, or dark field microscopy, into a grid, and then count each of the cells in each square of the grid.
That's right, that was automated.
But then when they invented the laser method of dropping the blood through a laser beam, and having stained, you know, given the patient something that will stain the cells different colours, and the laser beam can recognise the different colours and count the cells as as they go past, so you'll get so many white, so many red, so many blah, 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 and can actually distinguish between T4s and T8s, then you could each easily do, in a matter of minutes, what would have taken a week to do.
So what was the effect? That's right, I remember hearing that.
So suddenly, cell counts have become the all-important thing. Mm. Now, if the whole model of T4 cell turnover during the initial incubation period is such that the virus is about pumping out huge quantities of, you know, the cells are pumping out huge quantities of virus, the cell is, the body is manufacturing huge quantities of cells to deal with it. Surely a symptom during the incubation period should be an overproduction of T4 cells. And nobody knows what the standard number should be. They say it should be approximately between 1,000 and 1,200. You think, well, who established that? Dr. Gnotti-Ahulu, Felix Gnotti-Ahulu, this Ghanaian doctor, explained to me that there are tribes in Africa who never have more than 100 and are perfectly well. When they examine the Olympic athletes from, was it the last Olympics or the previous one, to see what their blood cell counts were like, they never had more than 600. And these were people trained to the peak of physical perfection. Your cell count goes up or down, whether you're in an aeroplane, whether or not you've just had a shock. I mean, shock can deplete the immune system just like that. Stress, they do reckon, is now... They've never taken into consideration until now the immunological, whatever it is.
Right.
But there is a connection between neural symptoms, signals, and
right.
the immune system.
Are you happy about the existence of all these cells? I mean, maybe there's some
evidence. I think it's a lot maybe bit misinterpreted, or we're still only in our infancy in finding out what exactly they do.
I've got a list of people. I was just scribbling out a list of people who, I don't know if you've spoken with. Do you speak to Reut, these Britons?
No, but I quote him in my paper.
Oh, right. He's a supposedly leading immune system theoretician.
Well, he's the guy who points out that it's Roit.
Yeah.
Well, he's the guy who wrote one of the standard textbooks and points out that HIV regularly infects a suspension of single follicular dendritic tonsil cells. He established that. Ivan Reut, is it?
I think that's right. Yeah. I tried to get this friend of mine, Hillman, would like to have spoken to him, but
yeah.
These people will not answer.
Isn't Reut at UCL?
I think something like that, yeah. He's certainly supposed to be
yeah.
a leading figure.
But UCL are hot shit hot at the moment working on vaccines using SIV. And what one of the students told Alex off the cuff was that they're finding it much easier to culture SIV, both in African green tissues and human tissues, than it ever has been for HIV.
What's the interest in the SIV?
Well, that's what they're using as the animal model to develop a vaccine. I think they're using SIV because they know damn well it is HIV.
Okay. How about...
What will depend, of course, is how long the SIV has been in the human bloodstream when they recover it as a sample of HIV to how much it's diverged from the original SIV.
Right. Okay. Have you ever spoken to Epstein?
Well, you know about SHIVs, don't you?
SHIVs. Never heard of them.
These are chimeric viruses.
Oh.
They deliberately put SIV and HIV into human cell cultures and breed hybrids, which they called SHIV, S-H-I-V, simian human immunodeficiency virus. Well, all you've got to do is cross the H out, and you've got the answer. All HIV is SHIV. But you see, think of that, what they've done. They've taken HIV, which is only partially speciated SIV, mixed it with the original neat SIV from the African green, and put it into the human bloodstream. So it's a doubly human-passaged SIV. So what's that going to tell them?
Right. Do they speak to you on this kind of subject? I mean, persona grata?
Well, I wrote a letter to TEDA outlining my hypothesis, and including that long list of coincidences. I haven't heard a word.
No, that's what I'd expect them to.
You see, they're all on their Olympian cloud, and us lesser mortals, oh, good heavens, what do they know? We can't be privy to their arcane mysteries.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're just standing waving at the gravy train as it goes past.
Well, it's a good trick, isn't it?
Mm.
If you can do it. Have you ever spoken to Epstein of Epstein-Barr?
No. But what's that got to do with lymphoma?
Epstein-Barr, I think... Oh, I don't know. I've just got the whole doubt about the whole...
But does it cause lymphoma? Why do the people who haven't got Epstein-Barr?
Burkitt's, I think...
Yeah, and then there's the Burkitt's lymphoma belt, isn't there, in Africa?
It's supposed to be to do with malaria or something like that.
But with my reactivation theory of a dormant SIV, you see, there again, the literature is full of... things like simian virus 40 itself may help the expression of HIV, because there is a degree of homology between the long-term and a repeat of HIV and the, what was it, core enhancer proteins of SV40.
If you've got HIV as being, can be relevant, why bother with it so much?
Well, no, I'm saying why it has acquired relevance is the fact that it's stimulated into a measurable form of activity. Normally it just remains dormant.
Mm.
But because of our super-sensitive needle-in-a-haystack methods, we can now detect even the lowest antibody response. You see, if my basic theory is correct, there will be an initial infection from the vaccine. The body will then generate antibodies to control whatever this new intruder is, at the same time that it's making the antibodies to the polio virus. If there should be an ab reaction, like this brief flu-like illness, which everybody refers to as the only symptom alleging HIV infection, then that will just be interpreted in an infant as an ab reaction to the vaccine. Oh. Then that passes, the virus is then dormant and just goes bye-byes, unless it's subsequently woken up by something else. Now, what could the something else be? Gallo has admitted it could have been the smallpox vaccine campaign. Vaccinia infection may reactivate the dormant HIV. SV40 infection, if it's in the same genome with HIV and it starts acting right up, could that trigger it into action? Herpes simplex is considered to reactivate HIV. Why not the hepatitis viruses? This is another thing they don't want to come clean about. It was presumed as from 1970, when Harold Tamin discovered reverse transcriptase, the enzyme which allows RNA to be transcribed into double-stranded DNA, that it was unique to retroviruses, but it's not. We've known since 1989, via Varmus and Blattner and other experts, Nobel-winning experts, that reverse transcription is common to most if not all mammalian and plant cells. It's common to these cells. It's not just the sine qua non of retroviral activity. For instance, all the hepatitis viruses have got reverse transcriptase. They all replicate via reverse transcription. Mm. But nobody knew this in 1970 or 76 when they were looking into the Lodell vaccines.
Mm.
But for Gallo to say in his book, when you find reverse transcriptase activity, it's clear indication of activity. He's wrong.
Gallo's book, Being Virus Hunting.
Mm.
So I've got a copy of that which I've never read.
You see, he admitted, when Peter Duisberg was giving his arguments, and now the key paper to get hold of, if you can get a copy, is Cancer Research, March the 1st, 1987.
Is that the 50-page one or so?
It's
a very long one.
It's about 27 pages, I think. And that was the one where he argues that the first two-thirds of the paper argue that HTLV-1 cannot be the cause of adult T-cell leukemia, and the last third of the paper is what shook everybody to their shoes, was the fact that he was saying, and on that evidence, the same evidence applies to HIV. It's never been shown, there's no mechanism demonstrable whereby it could be the cause of the destruction of human T-cells. You see, the only reason they ever used retroviruses as a candidate for the causation of cancer, which is the overmultiplication of cells, you know, the unstoppable proliferation, is the fact that retroviruses don't kill their host cell. But what they're having to say with HIV is it breaks all the rules of a retrovirus and destroys its host cell, either directly or indirectly. But they still have never demonstrated a mechanism for this. And there's more than 100,000 papers on the subject. We've had all sorts of theories about autoimmunity and apoptosis and all these other, you know, weird and wacky ideas.
Yes, I think that you count those both as being weird and wacky, do you?
Yes.
Autoimmunity.
Yes.
That's very interesting, yes.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, is that on just because you're generally kind of
scared? You see, if the body is tricked into thinking that something that comes into the body from the outside is so similar to something that's already in the body that it then starts to destroy the similar something that's already in the body, why did it ever see the interloper as a stranger anyway?
Well, that's right. There's also the problem that if you've got an autoimmune disease, so-called, why does it stop halfway? Why doesn't it destroy the whole thing?
Yes, quite. People with MS who go into remission are extremely important. You have read Elaine's papers, haven't you? Did you notice that study she cited where 41% of a cohort of MS patients were antibody positive for at least one of the proteins of HIV? But nobody's ever suggested that they've got HIV.
I did wonder whether multiple sclerosis people weren't an organophosphorus victim, because
Another thing I was trying to wondering about was this ME thing. I mean, whether one believes in the existence of ME or not, I tend to. I remember Joan Shenton and I. Joan's very sceptical about it, and we went to see this doctor at the Maudsley, and I said, "So what you're telling me then is ME is no more than a recrudescence of 19th century neurasthenia." He said, "Yes," but putting it like that, "Yes." I said, "I see." He said, "How else would you explain the Royal Free Hospital disease, Royal Free disease, they call it, because there was an outbreak of ME-like illness at the Royal Free, and they interviewed a nurse on television who was there at that time. She still survived, and she still got it." I said, "Did you ever stop to think whether all the hospital staff had just been vaccinated against polio?" He said, "What makes you say that?" I said, "I don't know. It might be worth looking into. Just look into it and find out." You see, one of the first things they did, once the polio vaccines had been okay, was to vaccinate all medical staff, airline flight stewards and everybody had to be, you know, all airline crews had to be vaccinated, diplomats, armed forces, and as I've said in my paper, if the vaccine, you see, Kyle said in his paper in The Lancet that there is evidence that vaccines made as late as 1985 contained retroviral contaminants.
Okay, so you're saying that retrovirus might cause ME?
We don't know, but certainly when we're talking about HIV infection, these mysterious cases where people go abroad and get infected with HIV, never having been infected with it in their own country, how do we know? If it was in the vaccine, how many people are told to have a vaccine and get a safety boost against polio before they go on holiday? Especially if it's to a third world country. And yet they claim it was the holiday romance that gave him the virus. See, that poor cow in Cyprus is going to have a hell of a job proving that it was his strain of virus that she got. You know the woman who's suing the Paolo, whatever his name is, for having knowingly infected her with HIV?
It's an interesting point, yes. My version, I've heard at least another two versions of ME, one of them being the organophosphorus explosion.
That is another possibility, yeah.
There's also the Harold Hillman one, which is, he's got the essentially a version of the R.D. Lang idea that he told me once, although he changed his mind later, that the people he'd spoken to with this, about 10 of them, all had personal financial problems which were kind of insuperable.
They were all under stress.
Well, insuperable problems of lifestyle or something, money.
Well, I talked to Claire Francis, who was one of the first people to go public on having had it. And it was known as, it's got so many different names, chronic fatigue syndrome, post-viral fatigue syndrome, myalgic encephalopathy, blah blah blah, but when I was talking to somebody else about this and saying, yes, but Claire Francis, you know, the woman who sailed the Atlantic, said, unusual woman, what is her problem? What is she neurotic about? Well, it's just if people don't want to sail the Atlantic single handed. Think about it.
Should I say that again?
Well-adjusted people don't want to sail the Atlantic single-handed.
So that's a whole thing.
Well, no, I mean, it is a stressful thing for anybody to do, but for a woman, did it tip something over? We don't know. Why are there more ME cases amongst women than men? On the other hand, what's her name?
The examples I had in mind were people with genuine, you know, like heavily in debt or...
Well, stress. Stressed people.
Yeah, but stress in a way which is unremovable, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the...
Well, I mean, they called it yuppie flu, didn't they? And Esther Ranson's daughter's got it. But then, of course, with a mother like Esther Ranson, you know, who wouldn't?
Actually, I spoke to, oddly enough, Esther Ranson's dad was a... I came across this by accident. There was a book, you know, I pick up books on myths and things.
Yes.
There's this book published by... somebody, Ranson, I've forgotten his first name now. I went to see him because he had an alternative view on things like radiation, radio feedback. He was an electronic engineer, basically.
Yeah.
and it was quite an interesting book, but I couldn't work out what he was talking about. It had statistical stuff in which I'm interested in, because I didn't a degree in maths. I went to speak to him, and I was very struck. You know, his wife really, I found her revolting, actually.
Yes.
She allowed her husband, you know, her husband was older than him. And I think as they'd aged, he'd got more and more decrepit.
Yeah.
And he was allowed to have his little room with his hobby in, you know.
Yes.
And of course, she had absolutely no interest in it at all.
No.
And he'd had various theories, including, for example, a new hearing aid and so on, which devolved upon his work. And I interviewed him and tried to get what he was talking about, but I could never successfully get it.
Mm.
But the point was, it was this kind of family situation where you had this wife who was very proud of Esther Ranson.
Yes.
But had no intellectual interest at all. Her success is entirely in terms of a media thing.
Yeah.
I could see how with that sort of family, I was not at all surprised that a daughter would end up with...
Well,
with
dysfunctional, others. Yes.
Yeah. So that was interesting.
But the guy at the morgue just poo-pooed the whole idea. But certainly a lot more psychiatrists are taking it.
It's very hard. I think there was something like...
You see, another thing I want to find out is, I interviewed a man called Ron Wiebeck in the programme we did on... called the AIDS Catch, and he had been diagnosed as having HIV and JC virus. Now, JC virus, there are two viruses, JC and BK, which would appear to be, they're named after the patients who they first isolated from. One causes, let me get this right, the JC causes a brain problem like AIDS dementia. The other causes, it's either a liver or a kidney thing, I can't remember which it is, that's the BK one. Probably kidneys, because they recovered it from BK's urine. Either way, he had HIV and JC virus. Now, JC virus and BK virus are very, very similar, if not the human hybrids of SV40.
Mm.
Okay? So, he also had AIDS dementia. How many people with so-called AIDS dementia are being examined for reactivated SV40 at this moment in time? Do they screen blood samples for it? If they'd known that the human bloodstream was infected with this virus, millions of people, for a period of something like 10 years before they even found the virus, what effect is it? Could it be having an effect now? We don't know.
Mm.
We just don't know.
That's interesting.
Oh, yes, polio is an enterovirus, isn't it? That's the word I was thinking of, enteric, you know, in the stomach.
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing, I'll just go up here. Tell me about the epidemiology of polio, how to crochet an epidemic. Tell you about how to crochet an epidemic.
Hey, let me just mention that Ken Russell's son is here.
Yes.
He doesn't look anything like him. But,
well, he's a spitting image of his brother, Toby Russell, who's they're identical.
Why isn't he a film director? Why isn't he making film?
He wants to, but you know, it's not that easy, especially when you've got a famous dad. But anyway, that's a long story.
All right,
story.
I'm sorry to...
Yes, do. Gordon Stewart is fascinating. Do you know Professor Gordon Stewart?
Ah, I've seen him on TV. He's got a Bertrand Russell type mien, hasn't he?
Yes, and a lovely Scottish accent. But he was explaining, because I went to him with his vaccine idea in about 1987-88. He said, you could have something. There could be something in this. He said, but let me explain what happened with the polio virus. The polio virus epidemic. He said, at the time that polio started to appear in America, they paid doctors a bounty of $25 to report any suspected cases of polio. Suddenly, there were no more official figures for suspected cases of viral meningitis. They disappeared completely. So a disease which had regularly thrown up something like 25,000 a year disappeared, and the number of polio cases went up by 25,000. Similarly, in India, when they had the anti-smallpox campaign, they couldn't vaccinate the whole population of India. So what they did was they subjected them to search and identify cases of suspected smallpox. Then they would isolate them and contain them. Okay, the immediate family members, people in the vicinity, whatever. And vaccinated a few other people. So people were asked to report suspected cases of smallpox. Suddenly, there were no official recorded figures for chickenpox anywhere in India. The moment the smallpox vaccination campaign was over, suddenly you have chickenpox cases in India again. So that's how you can boost the figures. Look at the way they finagled the figures for AIDS. First of all, they had how many diseases? 25, 26. And then they got demonstrations from the female lobby, because gay men on benefits get... Did you know that somebody on benefits in this country gets something like 380 quid a week, plus all their rent paid, whatever, whatever, whatever? If you're just an ordinary schlepper who's worked all his life in heavy industry and you've got mesothelioma or lung damage or whatever, you just get the very minimum, and if you're lucky, a visit from a Macmillan nurse once a week.
So, what do you have to do to get 380 quid a week?
Show that you have HIV positivity and difficulty walking. The scale of benefits for HIV positives is much higher than for other people claiming sickness benefits. Well, that is grotesque. There shouldn't be the discrimination. Why don't they give the same scale of payments to people with terminal cancer? So what was that leading off from? That was talking about...
Crocheting an epidemic. I've heard the same thing with BSE, actually, that, for example, cows with magnesium deficiency no longer exist. They're all... assigned to BSE.
Oh yes, of course. Sort of thing. Getting back to this, how they finagled the AIDS thing. When it appeared that AIDS figures were stabilising or beginning even to diminish, they had to reawaken interest. So they suddenly declared tuberculosis. Prior to this, non-pulmonary tuberculosis was to be the only kind of tuberculosis associated with AIDS. In other words, bone tuberculosis in the bone or wherever, osteotuberculosis, etc. And no form of cancer in women. But they, at a stroke, included cervical cancer as AIDS-related cancer, just to give the women some benefits and to get the female vote.
Yeah, to give women benefits, exactly. It's amazing.
Because women in America were getting angry that they were feeling left out because it wasn't their problem either.
They don't
have any
money for it.
So in a certain instance, a number of cases, you will find HIV antibodies in people with cancer, and I believe that they're an artifact of reawakening the dormant SIV.
I saw an amusing thing on the internet related to AIDS, that people getting benefits in the States because they get housing and so on.
Yeah.
But they're supposed to take AIDS-OT as well, you see, and they're all dying of it.
Yeah.
Since they've tweaked to the idea that it won't kill them, they refuse to take AIDS-OT, and so they're on benefits sort of indefinitely.
Oh, yes.
So they're trying to introduce things like painful things like spinal taps.
Oh, yes. Well, I think they're going to start looking at the benefit system in this country a lot more closely. They're going to have to, because they're milking it dry.
How many people are they getting?
Well, we know at least one who's... Well, we know two. A gay couple who've got a flat in London and a cottage in Dorset. They're both on full benefits, and they get a free car. Can I help you?
I was just looking for my glasses, actually.
Ah, yes, you looked up there just soon after you arrived, didn't you?
Silly of me. Huh?
Are they in your bum bag thing?
They're sort of... I don't think so. They're
no.
In terms of the...
Yeah. For that year.
Yes, I've heard that.
Yeah. So whenever interest in AIDS starts to flag, they just add a few more diseases in. Then, of course, you've got the bangy definition of AIDS in Africa and a totally different definition of AIDS in America. So you haven't even got a standard syndrome.
It's a masterpiece.
Well, you didn't come over here, did you? Now, that's my cheap old reading glasses. So I wonder where... You didn't come in a car, did you?
No. I say, I'm absolutely delighted to have kind of come across these continuum with your group.
Oh, yes. Well, this is they're going to be publishing my piece in the next issue. So far, it's 11,000 words.
You can circulate in a couple of thousand. But you're on the internet, by the way. Do you comb the airwaves?
Well, we searched the Philip Johnson AIDS, Rethinking AIDS internet thing.
Right.
And because they've got the best sceptics.
I noticed, when I was there, I showed Joan. James didn't know how to work the download the mail quickly.
No.
And there was a huge... And I showed her how to do it, and there's a huge list of... all these people like Lauritsen and so on.
Yes, and...
that's quite impressive.
Oh, Charlie, what's his name? I interviewed him. My memory for names is getting appalling, mind you, at my age. It's half of the course. So,
you've spoken to, for example, people like Richard Doll, doesn't he ring Bill?
I don't believe a word he says about lung cancer.
Alice Stewart, do you believe?
Hmm?
Have you spoken to Alice Stewart?
No.
I think she was the radiation woman who...
No.
...tipped off... the thing about X-rays. How about Les?
Oh, she was the one that was interviewed on telly recently, wasn't she?
Yeah, as being.
And they didn't want to know when she first suggested
distinguished
it.
Distinguished old woman.
Well, yeah, very old and very distinguished.
Doll was not very keen on her.
No.
Do you ever track down Leslie Munro? I keep trying to find him. He was a chap who, a few years ago, sprang to fame because he's investigated infant mortality in wet areas, areas with damp ground. And then there was a very insulting piece when they showed the Middlesex Hospital sort of taking over from him. Mm. Some bloke in a white coat saying that they couldn't possibly work with Munro because he was such a difficult chap.
Well, they didn't want to know about the bloke who first blew the whistle on BSC, did they? They said he was as mad as a hatter. No, the guy in Leeds. What's his name?
I don't remember.
That's another thing that struck me as odd. All this, what's this radon gas thing from Cornwall? I mean, Cornish people have lived for years with radon gas. What evidence is there going back in old medical records that people were more liable to the diseases alleged to be caused by radon gas? Oh, yes, they say, but now it's because people have got much better fitting doors and windows and central heating. And the radon gas doesn't escape, doesn't circulate. It concentrates in the buildings, comes up through the stone flooring and concentrates in the buildings.
Sounds like bollocks, doesn't it? Actually,
it totally.
I mean, I don't see how it can penetrate through the, even granted that it's a radioactive breakdown product.
So Joan told, oh, by the way, a message from Joan.
Oh, really?
She's still only halfway through your stuff about the upflows and downflows from chimneys and association with some form of disease or something.
What? Oh, that must be Van Steenis. Very nice chap, actually. Very interesting. He's a retired GP from Pembroke. Now, that's on the, you know, Wales have got two bits sticking out. He's on the bit at the bottom.
Yeah.
Sticking out. They've got a factory there, the National Power thing, that burns Orimulsion, you know, which is kind of, they call it bottoms, Venezuelan bottoms. It's got this, basically, a sort of, I can't imagine what it's like tarry stuff, but it's got heavy metal in a relatively high proportion.
Uh-huh. Mm.
So it distributes these fine particles of things like vanadium and arsenic. And all the local kids down, well, I mean, I would say all of them, the percentage of school kids with asthma inhalers is like 10 or 15% or something.
Higher than others.
That's ridiculously high percentage, 1 in 10, 1 in 8, 1 in 6. And if you draw a map of it, you get this very...
A clear demographic shape, yeah.
And of course, but,
but you see,
they
same
get paid
thing,
to burn this
Then
stuff.
They would argue that, you know, if you did the same sort of test in school children in high traffic areas in London, you'd find exactly the same result.
Oh, no, the asthma rate has definitely increased. I mean, it's nowhere near... I think there's supposed to have 3 million cases in Britain now, and there used to be sort of 50,000 or something.
Asthma is rocketing up. What about other factories that have the same system?
Oh, there was one in Richborough in Kent, which was closed down recently, which burnt the same stuff. There's no... I mean, he's got the figures as near as he can, but if he gets obstructed, they won't... say for reasons of confidentiality, they won't give him recent figures.
No.
And he says, well, you know, he's got a postcode breakdown, you see, which, of course, would preserve confidentiality, but they won't give him these figures either.
No.
He's got this whole intricate conspiracy theory involving local newspaper owners and, you know, Tory women who run things and all this kind of
stuff.
I'm sure he's right. And he did, in fact, get a broadcast on BBC, but it was all it was in Welsh on radio.
Oh, yes, I see.
They refused to translate.
Yes.
But he's done a quite nice little booklet, the A4 thing, for this organisation called Freedom to Care. It's a whistleblowers group.
Yeah.
And it would make a very good programme. It's very easy to understand.
Well, Joan says that she's got a 3-day deadline for our book. As you can see, what causes my asthma.
I don't know whether... I mean, from his point of view, it occurs to me that if he associates himself with... I mean, from my point of view, Meditel has got a good record in that.
Well, yes, I mean, and she knows how to break the whole thing down into a 3-page programme outline.
The trouble is...
You see, the problem is, if you send it as the full thing, they never read it.
Oh, I'm sure
you've got to hit them in the first page and a half, or you've lost the battle.
That's absolutely...
The problem is, at the moment, they're being assailed by all sorts of people who want to prove that people who live under power lines get more cancer than other people, and whatever. You see, that as far as I'm concerned, nobody gets cancer unless they are genetically predisposed to it. Why is it the first thing they ask any woman with a suspicious lump, have any blood relatives in your family, female blood relatives in your family, ever had these lumps?
It's hard to know, isn't it? The trouble with that sort of argument is, of course, you've got this business of separating out family influence, haven't you? They've had the same diet and everything.
Well, quite.
I mean, it seems unlikely. But
a genetic predisposition would argue that it can only be triggered by an other factor. You see, if all the girls in the family have got that genetic configuration, why don't all the girls in the family do
that? That's right, I don't go much for this genetic thing at all.
Well, I don't know. I think the clue about what causes cancer is still totally unknown.
Mm.
It could be a combination of genetic predisposition plus an infectious cofactor, i.e. papillomavirus.
Right.
It could be all sorts of things. But just to say, per se, we have found the cause of...
Mm.
You found a possible contributory factor, but...
If Joan Chittenden doesn't... I mean, would she be distraught if she lost this thing to somebody else?
No, but she wants to give it her best attention, but at the moment she's got...
Yeah,
you know Iraj Bagajani is publishing her book, and she's just putting her finishing touches to the references at the back.
She told me she was off to...
Whatever.
...for 6 weeks to teach as well. I'm not quite sure
what she's going to Jamaica to teach her a course in television management, or television documentary direction. To Jamaica media students.
She should make a documentary on it and send them that.
Oh, yes. Well, she brought their show reels back for me to sort of dub off as things. And some of them were very good. Very interesting subjects. But...
You're saying they're Jamaican?
Yes, the Jamaican made stuff.
Oh, right.
And one gorgeous girl reporter. She was absolutely beautiful. And I said to Joan, who was that wonderful girl? So she said, oh, she was Miss Jamaica. I said, well... Miss Jamaica or not, she was bloody good at the job too. And what was so lovely was hers was about reminiscences of very old women in Jamaica about how it used to be and how it is now and blah blah blah. And you've got this combination of this very gnarled old woman and this exquisite gorgeous young girl.
So if you get fed up with the stories, you can Google the young woman.
Yes. So anyway. Oh yes, Jones is a pretty rapidly moving target, but then she's pinning all her hopes. She's got 2 weeks of intensive stuff to do, this final putsch on the tranche of research to do for David Lloyd for this dispatches about the disparities in the HIV tests, and then if that gets the green light, off she will go with that one. But she's always likes to have another one up the spout.
Oh, I thought it was confirmed, or was it kind of historical?
Well, it's all but the last thing is we will give you this much extra money for 2 further weeks of development, which is usually interpreted as meaning either we're 99% sure we're going ahead with it, or we're 100% sure we're going ahead with it. That is just to give you some money to keep you going until we actually say go.
That's good news, eh?
Yeah.
It's just coming that if... I mean, I think Van Steenis is right. But from his point of view, it might be better for him not to go, you know, because they're going to throw everything at him, you see.
Mm.
They're just going to say there's a cranky group of people.
You see, that would appeal to David Lloyd.
Mm.
Because you would say, you know, why are people not being listened to who subsequently turn out to be right? But at the moment, there is usually so much vested interest in stifling. Everybody's got an interest in the truth not coming out in science these days.
Yes.
In olden times, what they looked for was truth. Now they look for expediency.
What's this David Lloyd character like?
Oh, very hard-hitting. I mean, when you go for an interview, my God, he puts you through the third degree. And asks you all the most... He does the most difficult vivas in the world, because he will always hit you with that out-of-left-field question which you just hadn't even thought about, and you just sit there gasping like a fish out of water, you know.
Oh, that's good, isn't it?
I mean, oh, it is, very good.
You get through that.
Yeah, but once you can get through... I mean, Joan and I have sometimes sat in his office, well, 3 times now, to get the 3 AIDS commissions that we got, and we've had... And she said, well, I always take you with me, Michael, because you can remember the virology and the epidemiology and the... I say, I remember all the ologies, and all she does is dress good and look good. You know, but, you see, she can do the hard sell, but then when he says, yes, but what evidence have you got for this, this, and this, and you say, well, there's this paper by so-and-so, and there's this paper by so-and-so. And that seems to be...
Is she good at the hard sell?
She's got a good
way of doing it, kind of
thing. Well, she's very good at persuasive. She's very persuasive, well, as women are. And, whereas I try to sort of back everything up with saying, yes, but according to the evidence, there's this, 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 and this, but then they deliberately ignored this evidence, that, and that. And that's what David likes.
Yeah. Has Lloyd been there since, you know, like 8 years, 10 years?
Founding father of dispatches.
Oh, really?
And we won him his first RTS. In fact, we won Channel 4's very first Royal Television Society Award. So they...
Does that mean you've got a sort of a piece of perspex somewhere with it?
No, we didn't get the piece of perspex, they did. But I've got a copy of the certificate
that
we were awarded. And we all went to the big celebration at... they had a party at the Hilton. Not the Hilton, what's the other big hotel next door to it? The Dorchester. And then all the various other companies that had been nominated and didn't win had all taken sweets in the Dorchester for the night to entertain, you know, and kibbutz. And, of course, we, poor little Meditel, we just went in rented suits in a taxi to the Dorchester. So we crashed everybody else's parties, flaunting our framed certificate. It was quite a night. It was the first time anybody had ever queried the AIDS hypothesis. But more and more people are coming round to the idea that HIV cannot be the causative agent.
Well, and a lot of people, of course, have noticed that there's not a huge epidemic. So.
Well, where is the epidemic? I mean, as I said to David Lloyd, and he fell about laughing, I said, what would happen if they threw an epidemic and nobody came?
Right. Have we got to the end of what we were talking about?
I think so.
That's...
No, I mean, obviously a lot remains to be shown and proved and final I's and final T's dotted with this HIV within vaccines. You see, for instance, they found HIV-2 in Western Africa, which is much more akin to the Sooty Mangabe virus, SIV, but I can't prove that Sooty Mangabe were ever used in the manufacture of vaccines. And if so, would they have been restricted to local usage in West Africa? Yes, if it was made by the French. Oh, that was something very interesting. Remember I told you about this woman called Madame Simon de la Rue?
Yeah, yeah.
She had written to the French Ministry of Health, alarmed that African green monkeys have been used in the production of polio vaccines, and as they are now shown to be infected with a version of HIV called SIV, were they a contaminant in French-made polio vaccines? And she was reassured by the woman in the French Ministry of Health. She showed me the letter, gave me a photocopy, I let somebody else have it, they never gave it back to me. Reassuring her on two counts. One, that SIV doesn't infect kidney cells. What she forgot to mention was that 90% of a body's lymphocytes are confined to the organs of the body, so it would be virtually impossible to get a culture of kidney cells that didn't contain at least product of lymphocytes. Right. The other thing that reassured her was, meant to reassure her, the French stopped using African greens in 1982 and switched to Patas Rouge. Why? Well, in 1982 they discovered that African greens were infected with a virus called STLV, 100%, 95 to 100% homologous, with HTLV-1, an alleged human cancer virus. So they switched species. And subsequently they were shown to be right, because Meyer and Essex and his colleagues showed that the Patas Rouge monkeys don't carry a retrovirus. Certainly they don't carry STLV or SIV. That was in Scientific American, October 88.
Do you memorise all these things?
Well, I've, you know, read them all backwards and forwards. And I can remember the key papers that I need.
How does the multi-named Hector...
Oh, Simpson, Gildermeister, Beast of Belsenau. I call him all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Is he sat? I mean, I lost my temper with him, which is silly.
Oh, that's not. That's par for the course.
Oh,
and Hexer is just a silly, wittering gentleman. You see, when he has to shout to win an argument, you know he's lost the argument. And it's a shame, because he has got a good mind. It's just that he keeps up going off at tangents all the time.
Does he contribute things?
Not really. I mean, he sometimes writes an article for Continuum, which doesn't consist so much of pure science as ad hominem attacks on scientists, which never proves anything scientifically.
Okay, that's the impression I got.
And he wrote a scathing attack on David Ho, called Ho Ho Ho, or whatever it was, and a scathing attack on Robert Gallo. Well, I mean, scathing attacks on Robert Gallo are par for the course. It's like shooting fish in a barrel.
It's nice to get the occasional... bit of stuff
like that. Yes. But Gallo is such a nasty piece of work and ruthlessly ambitious. And having had that initial success with being credited as the... Well, he and Myron Essex together...
That's his only success, wasn't it?
Finding the human virus that causes cancer, which we've now shown doesn't cause an adult T-cell leukemia either. You know, so... There you go. Hello. Cynical. The race is on now to see who can get credit for a vaccine for an epidemic that never was.
So,
if it was SIV in the vaccines, they've obviously cleaned up their act since 1985 with the awareness of AIDS, etc. And they now don't make any polio vaccine that contains a retrovirus. But if they were still marketing vaccines made as late as 1985, then that means you're going to find a residual number of people who may turn up HIV positive. But if you've wiped, if you've cut off the source of supply of HIV, and it isn't to any appreciable extent transmitted horizontally, there's no reason why, for instance, a girl who was vaccinated against polio in, say, 1960 shouldn't have had a child by 1980 and pass the virus on to her child, as lentiviruses are transmitted from female to offspring. So you might have that kind of aggravation. But there again, you see, how many babies have been diagnosed as having HIV who got it from their polio vaccine? The first 6 months of life, you get three different shots of polio vaccine, and another one prior to attending primary school.
I thought you were working on cancer, actually, now I come to think of it. I thought Joan Shenton said you were frantically reading up.
Oh, not cancer, no. I mean, okay. Don't forget I was... Duisberg is an oncologist and a retrovirologist, and that's his big bag, cancer research. And he'd won, you know, lots of prizes and was going to be the man most likely to get the Nobel for...
So he spent whatever. Years wasted...
He discovered oncogenes. Then he got sort of sidetracked into this AIDS thing, and all he did was publish a paper that, as far as he could see on the available evidence, HIV couldn't possibly be the cause of AIDS. And from there on, it sort of sucked him in, and he became the world's leading AIDS dissident. It's ruined his career. I mean, they cut off his grant funding. He's persona non grata wherever he goes. I remember I went over to listen to him lecture in Berlin, and the students had packed out the hall waiting to hear the great man. When we could finally get in the hall, because a crowd of dissident, you know, HIV orthodox people, students, with banners, you know, the typical yahoos, had locked all the doors and wouldn't let us into the hall. And when he started his lecture, they went into the control room where they were operating the sound system from, and literally wrestled the console operator away from the console and fucked up the sound system. They didn't want Duisberg to speak. So when the Germans were saying something about, he's got no right to say this, I said, have you ever read Duisberg? No. I said, well, surely you should have learned from your own history. Even if you're going to burn the books, read them first.
Yes, I bet that went down like a...
Oh, like a lead balloon. I'm marked for death on somebody's list.
Well.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. That's pretty good.
So anyway, I'll get Joan to get back to you when she's had more time to look at the thing. But if your chum thinks he can do better with it elsewhere, you know, it's...
He was approached by another company. Well, it's not so much doing better, it's just that I thought that he ought to avoid getting, you know, tagged with another controversy. That's all.
Yeah.
It's his decision, it has nothing to do with me, really.
Yeah, but how controversial will it be if he can actually prove his point?
Well, it's controversial in the sense that it shows the health and safety executive were... negligent.
Yes, but you see, that's always the difficulty, because it smacks of conspiracy theories, and was there a conspiracy about so-and-so? You see, if my theory about HIV and SIV is correct, it wasn't a conspiracy, it was just a ghastly accident that nobody's ever come clean about. Probably, and they would have, their defence would be, we saw no reason to cause general panic.
I think this business with Ori Mulchen is not in that category, because... there are very few countries which allow it to be burnt, apparently. I mean,
but why did Wales? Do they still burn it?
Well, the asthma rate in Britain is supposed to be one of the highest in the world, I think. Yes, they do. Yeah. I mean, in some, it's to do with counties as well. You know, you have local
authorities can take those decisions.
Well, yeah, and I mean, for example, GP, he's got 41 GPs on his side, except one of them who's in the same, who's the GP directly underneath the factory chimneys, as I understand it.
Yeah. But has anybody actually done a programme about the connection with ME and organophosphates?
I think that's been worked into it. You know, they show these interviews with
I mean, they show... I mean, the programmes always are on the basis of does it exist or doesn't it exist? Yes. But for somebody who actually could take the premise, yes, it does exist, and bring out all your experts who agree, yes, it does, and say, what is the connection between that and organophosphates?
I think that could be a good programme.
I'd also like to see a programme that correlates BSE with organophosphates.
There was one, the one with Purdy in on Channel 4, it showed him working on his stuff. It didn't actually show, as far as I can remember.
But nobody followed it up, did they? It's almost as if there's a conspiracy of, you know, it falls into a pool of silence, like Joan always describes how our first AIDS programme went down.
That's right.
Everybody ignored it.
Well, I mean, MAF has an important interest in not
Mm.
If they were wrong all the time, they've slaughtered.
Yeah.
I don't think they're feeding it.
Quite.
A huge, most of Britain's cows or something.
Yeah. Yes, you see, we will never know the name of the bureaucrat who signed the form which said it was a good idea to feed sheep bits to cows, will we? All these people get away with it. Do we know the names of the guilty men in the thalidomide scandal? But you see, because both America and Britain have the state-of-the-art defence, there was no reason to suppose from the scientific evidence available at the time that, which is the equivalent of, we were only obeying orders, we did not know they were burning the bodies, sort of argument, they'll get away with it.
It's all very, all this stuff is difficult. In fact, I looked up these so-called historical revisionists, and I thought they made quite a good case, actually.
Mm.
Another disconcerting thing.
Yeah. Yes.
That this business of 6 million was just...
Oh, yes, David Irving and all that lot.
Well, there's some other ones.
And you think, well, how do they know it was a precise 6 million?
Well, apparently the figure was got by some German bloke who was being tortured, and they said, right, sign this piece of paper, and they made up the figure. To make it bigger than any other minority.
The group, yes, but I mean, has anybody worked out accurate figures for gypsies, gays, political prisoners, Russians?
It's depressing. I looked at on this, and I was surprised that they had quite a good case. I mean, for example, the business about gas ovens, even apparently, is not all gas chambers is not definitive.
Well, ergonomically, it wasn't.
It's the impression I got that they're very small things. And they did actually use them for lice, although it sounds kind of like...
Yeah.
Because if you look up Penguin Books of the time, it's a quite useful source, actually, on... You've heard of a chap called Zinser. He wrote a book called Rats, Lice and History, which was very popular. It's quoted Popper. Came out in about 1940 or something.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of stuff in there about lice, and it was a very live issue. And if you're in somewhere like Russia, if you're being attacked by the Nazis and you've got... The hygiene, of course, is complete crap.
Mm.
You do get... There was a serious problem with contamination of these things.
Mm.
So I do suspect there's something in this revisionist thing, although it's...
Oh, I remember ringing a Cambridge professor about... when I was wondering how HIV was being spread. This was in the days when I believed that HIV was the cause of AIDS. I wondered if it could be insect-vectored or arthropod-vectored. And he said, oh, no, because I wondered about crab lice. Were they a vector for the virus? And he said, well, it's awfully tempting, he said, to think of it, if AIDS is a sexually transmitted disease. He said, but I assure you, their mouth parts and their stomach, whatever, there's no way it could support the virus. I said, well, would it have to? Would it have to be able to be resident in the louse and replicating? What about blood on its mandibles or whatever that gets into another... person if it jumps from host to host? He said, no, that wouldn't be a viable way of it being transmitted. And apparently he learned everything he knew from Miriam Rothschild, the world's great louse expert. So, I was assured by him. And then when I put the same thing to Peter Duisberg, only in the context of mosquitoes, because there was evidence that mosquitoes have a certain section of their genome which is homologous to a bit of HIV. And he said, so explain to me why the mosquitoes on a crowded beach in California only bite the gays. You see, if everybody eats at a common trough, why is it only that some people get ill? I was talking to Peter Jones at the Newcastle Infirmary about haemophiliacs, because I thought the haemophiliacs held the key to the whole thing. And there's something, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Edinburgh Cluster, the Edinburgh Cohort, but it was a group of haemophiliacs in Edinburgh who were given the same batch of factor VIII, batch A, it was called the notorious batch A.
Mm-hmm.
Half of them were infected by it and half of them weren't. Why weren't the other half? In other words, my theory would fit it exactly, that what was in batch A was an antigenic something or other, activator, for the half that had got the SIV in their polio vaccine, whereas the other half didn't. You see, even in the vaccines, it wasn't a question of every contaminated batch of vaccine would have an infectious agent capable of producing a systemic productive infection. See, if you're infected with a defective virus that can never replicate, you will still generate antibodies. But there are numerous cases cited in the literature of people who make antibodies but from whom they cannot culture virus. You think, well, in that case, if they can't block the culture virus, they haven't got actual replicating virus. What they've got is antibodies from a previous viral infection, which wasn't productive. Unless you can culture virus, you haven't got the actual replicating virus in your system, have you?
Mm.
And that was one of the first ways that they put PCR through its paces to see whether it worked. They took blood samples from 11 people who were HIV positive but from whom they could not culture virus, and sure enough, out of the 11, I think it was 7 out of the 11, they were able to detect provirus. But 6 of the proviruses were defective and could never be expressed, so that only one of them had potentially active virus. But what they didn't mention was the 4 that had antibodies and no trace of provirus. What I want to know is if they say the virus is infectious via bodily fluids, are antibodies infectious via bodily fluids? If your body is carrying the antibody complexes, why not that? Why not the antibodies? In other words, you're not infected with HIV, but somebody else's antibodies to it. Then you would be making anti-antibodies, wouldn't you? And so everybody disappears at their own fundament.
I must send you a copy. I'll send you a photocopy of Louis Pasteur's.
Oh, that would be a boon if you could manage to do that for me.
I scanned it in. Right? Sometimes I scan stuff in, and so I've got, so it's computer searchable.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Oh, I'd welcome the Pascal thing.
All right, I'll send it to you as soon as I can, a couple of days probably.
I've never been able to get in touch with Walter Kyle, actually, but I'm sure he must be the lawyer behind this lawsuit that I quoted for you.
If you're interested, I could also send you a copy of a MSc thesis dissertation by a woman called Warman, who lives in St. Albans.
Yeah.
She's a friend of this friend of mine called Kat.
Mm-hmm.
And she got onto this quite a long time ago. All it is really is a survey of people's beliefs, students' beliefs in particular, about AIDS.
Yeah.
And she was very dubious about the whole thing as well.
Mm. Do you know Lady Colfox?
No.
Lady Frederica Colfox. Her 2 children have both got ME. But then, funnily enough, she's a rather strange lady who is heavily into alternative medicines, etc., along with Lord Baldwin. And we all went along to have drinks at the House of Lords one afternoon. And I thought I might send him a copy of my paper about the polio vaccines. You see, it would also explain why there must have been a certain degree of imported vaccines used in Britain, but how quickly did Britain become self-supportive, you know, self-sufficient in polio vaccine production? And if they were using the Burroughs Wellcome one that utilised diploid cells, human diploid cells, they wouldn't have got HIV anyway. So, but we don't have a very high HIV positive rate in Britain compared with other countries. I mean, what I need to know is if anybody's ever got one, a complete list of all the world's polio vaccine manufacturers, which monkey species they used, and which countries did they export to. That would be useful. Correlations between compulsory polio vaccination and high HIV incidence.
Information exists.
Well, it must exist somewhere.
It must.
You see, I don't know whether all the other countries are like America, but if you get a license to manufacture polio vaccine, it's with the American government, grants you the license.
That's right, so the ministries of health should have
so the minister, our ministries of health should have the same sort of information, but whether or not they give it out, I don't know. But, you see, so as I've said in my piece, even the manufacturers of the polio vaccine are in no way blameworthy for this. First of all, as Robin Wise said, when they forbade the use of xenotransplants, you cannot screen out something that's not known to science because you haven't got an assay to detect that it's there. So they're not responsible from that point of view. And even after the contaminants have been found and the government gave them permission to carry on making the vaccine, the government allowed them to have what was considered to be a permissible level of contaminants, so they were only acting according to government guidelines. And presumably the government had been advised by the finest scientific minds available.
Hmm.
You see, it all started to fall into place as well with, you know, that there was a lot of talk about the number of airline stewards, because the majority of them are gay because they're so good at the job, who developed AIDS. And you thought, well, this is because they went round the world and had sex in every touchdown, you know.
Yeah.
But if they were given dose after dose of polio vaccine for, as part of the terms of employment, when I was looking into the smallpox story that the Times had covered in April 87, I rang the doctor for British Airways, and they put me through to their chief medical officer for British Airways. And I said, I'm looking into the Times story about the smallpox vaccination. At what time did you stop making smallpox vaccination compulsory for your airline crews and staff? He said, not till 1981. They declared it officially stopped, you know, eradicated by 1979.
But they still kept...
But the airlines, just to be on the safe side, didn't abandon it until 1981. And the rule was, as a condition of employment, they had to be vaccinated against